will call the meeting of the Property and Local Sales Tax Division to order, and I don't know if we have a quorum.
Thank you so much.
We'll, okay. Well, we do have a quorum, and so, let's see. Representative Peterson moves the minutes of the previous meeting. Okay. Representative Peterson, any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes pass. Okay. We have a long agenda today, and a busy couple of weeks coming up, so I just want to draw your attention here to the timeline that was put on your seats. So it kind of lays out exactly what we're going to be needing to do to put together a bill to have it out of here and on to tax committee. So, at any rate, and we do have a big agenda. We'd love to be able to get through it this morning, but if not, we're prepared to meet tonight as well. So, kind of bear that in mind. All right. We have Representative Anderson. Welcome to the committee, Representative Anderson. And we have your bill, House File 143.
Thank you.
So I'll move House File 143. And these are for possible inclusion in the tax bill, so in the property tax bill.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. This bill was brought to me by a township in my home county, Polk County. It's Glenwood Township. And they have six major gravel pits in their township and some contractors that haul a lot of gravel out of the township. And they are just looking to be able to capture a little bit of revenue for road maintenance is what they're looking at. And they would like to assess this gravel tax of between 2 and 3 cents a yard. Not a huge amount, but just some revenue to give them some money to maintain roads that these gravel trucks go across their township roads and do some damage at times because they're big, heavy trucks. And I'm passing around a resolution passed by the town board. This was brought to me by the town board. They are in full support of this. The county engineer is also okay with the township having its gravel tax. And again, they're looking to collect between 2 and 3 cents a yard from these producers that to haul gravel out of their township. And I would be willing to stand for questions, Madam Chair.
Any questions, members? Okay, I would like to just find out, is this something, Ms. Dalton, that we have done in the past? Is we're just adding another area to do it?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, we have actually done this 3 times in the past, once for 12 townships in St. Louis County, once for a township in Otter Tail, and I forget what the third county, one for a township in Cass County. Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Well, great. Seeing and no opposition and no questions. Anyone from the audience have anything to say? Great. Thank you, Representative Anderson. And
thank you, ma'am.
We will lay this over then. What? I'm sorry. Was there an additional? Was someone else interested in speaking? Oh, I'm sorry. All right, and next, drum roll, please. We have Representative Davids, and that's HF 22, members. Good morning, Representative
Thank you,
Davids.
Chair.
You've been up a long time already this morning?
Yep, good working at it. Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 22 is a bill that was heard last year. There's been a few things added to it, however, and I want to thank former Chair Marquardt for having included this in the bill in his property tax division bill last year. And what it does is it changes a property it reduces property tax classification 4C for properties consisting, and it's written very narrowly, of not more than 20 residential units that are open less than 250 days a year and that are located in a town with a population under 2,500. And we even make it down, make it even more specific. Provided that a state trail passes through that city or town. And so what's happened, and I'm carrying this on behalf of the city of Lanesboro, and actually it would affect, I think, the city of Leroy also, and anyone that can fit into that narrow classification there. These bed and breakfasts, they're Help me out, Mr. Hines. What are they?
Inns.
They're inns. They're inns. Inns of less than 20 units, and it would their property tax classification is quite high. And there's things that they're doing right now to qualify for the lower tax rate. Right now, they have to have a bait and tackle or some things like that for sale in their inn. Well, the problem with that is they don't really need to be selling bait and tackle in these inns. So it just cleans it up the two towns I can think of right now would be Lanesboro and Leroy that would fit this, and there could be some others also.
Members, any questions of Representative Davids?
Madam Chair.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. After the questions are, I'm talking about Section 1. There's also some cleanups that Mr. Hines has worked on. I don't think it really affects what I'm trying to do with my bill, and maybe Mr. Hines could describe what else I'm doing here.
So, Mr. Hines, do we have a delete all then?
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, yes, first we should be acting on the delete everything amendment.
Excuse me, if someone could move the bill and then move the amendment.
Okay, Representative Davids. The chair lays over House File 22, moves to lay over House File 22 for possible inclusion in the Property and Local Tax Division report, and I move the DE2 amendment. And any discussion on that, members? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Davids. Do you know anytime we shift property tax, make a different classification, we're shifting a cost to someone else? Do you know what the cost is of your particular shift, making a new classification, and who gets to pay it? Of course, you know, I do want to be as gentle as I can with the tax chair.
Representative Davids.
Well, since when? as far as if you look at the revenue or from Minnesota revenue, the as far as any state impact, there's none, but that's not the question. The question is, who does it shift to locally? Mr. Hines, was there any... I don't think it was too severe at all.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, the revenue analysis indicates that they think there would just be a few properties that would qualify, so would not be much shifting, but it would be shifting to the other local taxpayers in the city, the county, school district, et cetera. But they indicated they thought very few properties would qualify.
Mm-hmm. Senator Mahoney?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, if Mr. Hines could describe what else I'm doing here, because I have no clue.
Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, the DE2 amendment is a very long section of law, this 273.13 sub 25, and when I was discussing it with the advocates, we ended up deciding that we could shorten that section a little bit by doing a little bit of cleanup in there. So you'll see a number of places where there's lines that are being stricken, and then there's a couple places where there's descriptions of these various recreational activities, and we were able to replace those with just one description at the end, and a few other things like that are taking place. But the provision that Representative Davids is, it's in the bill, is the part on page 2, lines 20, lines 29 to 33 is really the only parts of it that are the bill itself. The rest of the changes are a little bit recodification and cleanup.
Okay, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, any further discussion on the DE2 amendment? All right.
Seeing Thank you very none, much, Madam Chair and members.
Seeing none, the chair lays over House File 20. Oh, we adopt the amendment. Sorry. Having adopted the DE2 amendment, we will be laying over House File 22 as amended for possible inclusion in the Property and Local Tax Division report. Oh, we have to vote. I'm sorry. All right. We've been busy. All right. All in favor of adopting the DE2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Same sign? Okay. DE2 amendment is adopted. And we will lay the bill over, House File 22, as amended for possible inclusion in the division report.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. And I'm going to move then in the next item here to bring House File 112 to the committee. And we have Representative Barrett. How was the drive in from Taylor's Falls?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'd like to move House File 112 for possible or for discussion here today in our committee.
Great. Thank you. And do you have some testifiers then that you would like to bring, or do you want to describe the bill for us?
Sure. I will just introduce to you Mayor Mike Buchheit from City of Taylor's Falls is with me today. And also Chris Ng, he is the Executive Director of the Chisago County Economic Development Authority. Mm-hmm. They'll be testifying. I'm going to set the stage, and then I'll turn it over to my experts. So House File 112 allows the City of Taylor's Falls to be included in the Border City Development Zones, currently in statute. The Border City Development Zone statute has been in place for many years and allows cities who are economically disadvantaged by their close proximity to a neighboring low-tax city on the other side of the border to designate all or a part of their city as a Border City Development Zone. The purpose of the bill and this existing statute is simple: to encourage economic development and job creation. The bill appropriates funding for up to $100,000 to be used for property tax exemption for the City of Taylor's Falls. Just to let you know how close Taylor's Falls is to Wisconsin, St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin is the neighboring city. I might be the only politician in the state who has actually walked in a parade in another state because they're that close. The bridge is 220 feet long, Taylor's Falls on one side, St. Croix Falls on the other. St. Croix Falls has a Kentucky Fried Chicken, a Walmart, a Dairy Queen, a Menards, a Coney Market, and various manufacturing sites there. A lot of it is related to property tax and the disadvantage we have in our city and our state with higher property taxes, especially in the business. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Mayor Mike, who will explain in more detail what we would like to do.
Good morning, and please give us your name and who you represent for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Michael Buchheit, and I'm the mayor of Taylor's Falls, and I appreciate.
Would you mind spelling that for us?
Yes, it is spelled B-U-C-H-I-T-E.
Thank you.
Thank you, and Madam Chair, I appreciate your time. I know that you're all very busy, just like I am, so I will be brief. Those of you who are not familiar with Taylor's Falls, we have a population of 1,031 people, and I consider us a true border city. As Representative Barrett said, the distance between St. Croix Falls and Taylor's Falls is 220 feet. I've given you a handout that shows the St. Croix River that runs between our two cities. Now, St. Croix Falls, they're twice our size in population, and they have a levy that is three times larger than our levy limit. So I have some real competition. St. Croix Falls has some real tax advantages when it comes to commercial and industrial property. I have no industrial park. The times are tough. I know that. They're very tough. But I've been lowering taxes. When I came to Taylor's Falls as their mayor, the tax rate was 102. And the tax rate today is now 80. I've reduced taxes 7 out of the last 8 years. 2005, I had a minor increase, 1%. Now, I've come here today because I have a plan. If you take a look at the handout that I've shown you, I'm going to build a business park. Now, I have the land. I have that because I partnered with Xcel Energy to get that land. We're going to put in the infrastructure. I'm partnering with the Chisago County HRA EDA to put in that infrastructure. And once that infrastructure is in this summer, I'm going to give the land away to attract businesses to Taylor's Falls. I'm talking new businesses, new jobs, and new revenue. That's how I'm going to attract businesses to Taylor's Falls. Now, last fall, I heard a lot of campaign promises. I heard a lot of people in Minnesota talk about jobs, and I'm waiting, but I have a plan. Now, if you take a look at the other handout I've given you, that's a map of Wisconsin. I see that every time I drive into Wisconsin. As you go up the hill, it not only says, "Welcome to Wisconsin," it says industrial, it says agricultural, it says recreational. And at the very bottom, they got a brand new sign they added in January that says, open for business. So my question for you today is, what are you going to do about this? Are you going to leave me hanging? I need a little bit of help here. I can tell you that I've got a plan. I'm not going to hit anybody. I'm going to build a business park. And I need you to do just one thing for me. Lower, level the playing field between us and Wisconsin. I need a level field. Allow me to compete. So thank you for your time. Again, I know you're very busy. With that, I'd like to pass the microphone to Chris Ng. He is our Chisago County HRA EDA director.
Good morning, sir, and please give us your name and who you represent, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair members. My name is Chris Ng, ENG. I'm the executive director of the Chisago County Economic Development Authority, and I thank you for your time this morning to come and testify on the Border Cities Development Zone. As the mayor and Representative Barrett indicated, one of our biggest challenges for economic development in our county is our competition from Wisconsin. We're working very hard to keep the businesses that we've got, and it's an uphill battle. We've lost seven businesses in the past 7 years to Wisconsin. In fact, if you look at the Osceola, Wisconsin Industrial Park, there are 21 businesses in that park. 17 of them are from Minnesota. And so we're trying hard to keep the businesses we have, but it's even harder for us to try to attract new businesses into our community because they'll look 200 feet across the border and ask what Wisconsin has. And the mayor indicated that there's a new sign up in Wisconsin that says open for business, but that's not really new. Wisconsin has been competing and challenging our businesses for the past 10 years or more. In fact, I've got a letter here from 2004 from the governor, Governor Doyle at the time, saying, come on, move your business over to Wisconsin. We'll save you 50% on your industrial and commercial property taxes, and we'll also save you 40% on your workers' compensation rates. And by the way, we'll also save you 20% on corporate income taxes and our sales taxes lower, and we'll give you free land and incentives on top of that. So it's hard for us to compete with what they're offering. When the mayor talks about giving away land to create jobs in the city, that's really all we have. We can offer tax increment financing, but Wisconsin will already do that, and when the tax increment financing district is completed, they're still going to blow us out of the water. So what we're asking for is some way to level the playing field with our competition to bring jobs back to Taylor's Falls and Chisago County. I have a printout for you that I've handed out, and I'm going to be brief on this because I want to respect your time. If you look at a business that is valued at $588,000, the total tax in Taylor's Falls is $23,313. That same business valued at the same amount in St. Clair Falls, Wisconsin, 200 feet across the river, is $11,000. Substantially huge savings for the business. And when you're looking at the bottom line for business, when they're competing one city against another, one state against another, we're going to lose every time. We just can't compete with that. And at the same time, our unemployment rate is 8.6% right now in Taylor's Falls, and it's 7.9% in St. Clair Falls. So I guess with that being said, we'll open it up for questions, or certainly be
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ng, I know last fall when I was on the Canadian County Board, you made a presentation to us, and you mentioned the Osceola phenomenon of 21 businesses being there, 17 starting in Minnesota. And I'm sure you've talked with some of those businesses. You've kind of outlined in general what those reasons are for those businesses going over there. Can you tell us what 1, 2, and 3, what the reasons are that they've given for doing that?
Mr. Ng.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. It's primarily the business tax climate. If they were going to expand in Chisago County, I'll give you an example. F&M Plastics out of Schaefer just relocated into the Osceola Industrial Park, and it would have cost them double to expand their business in Chisago County versus Osceola, who gave them free land and gave them some incentives. Wisconsin has a new law that I just found out from talking to Commissioner Phillips last week. They'll also offer the first 2 years of income tax exemption. If for any company that moves from Minnesota to Wisconsin, now they get 2 years of income tax exemption as well. So it's just it's an uphill battle, and we're trying real hard just to level the playing field so we can keep what we've got, but then maybe have the opportunity to attract some of those Wisconsin businesses back to Minnesota.
Other questions, members? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and Representative Barrett. Appreciate you moving this forward. I represent two full cities and border cities and part of another one, Dilworth and Breckenridge and then Moorhead. And that's always, you know, it's a preference, of course. So I always want to make sure that it's actually based on good foundation and so forth. But I know back in 83 when they initially did a study, the state did, to look at these kind of fiscally distressed communities that were negatively impacted by borders. At that time, they indicated along the Red River border, North and South Dakota, they saw that, but at that time, of course, almost 30 years ago, they didn't see that disadvantage on the eastern side. And I certainly, with the property tax increases, I see that difference there. The other couple factors they looked at were unemployment, compensation, and then workers' comp. And I know you mentioned a letter from Governor Doyle, but do you have some differences? And just in the, if you could give me quickly, in the last like 30 years, what has kind of changed in between Wisconsin and Minnesota there, if you could, please?
Mr.
Any, I guess, Representative Barrett, any of the witnesses, I don't know.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, thank you for the question. I'm not sure there's been a change. It's that they've always been aggressive, but quite frankly, lately, they're eating our lunch when it comes to economic development. We've got very little to offer a company to incent them to move to Taylor's Falls or to Chisago County right now. Really, the only thing that we've got is are two programs that are really at the local level. It's tax abatement and tax increment financing. And in both of those cases, tax abatement especially, we don't offer any school rebates. We don't offer any state rebates. We can't. So really, we're offering just the local portion of the property tax in form of a rebate. We used to have the Minnesota Investment Fund where the state would invest, a couple million dollars every year from the general fund into a state's revolving loan fund at deed. That program is gone. Those funds are no longer available. So really, we've got very little to offer. And so Wisconsin hasn't stopped offering incentives. They're continuing to do it. We did have the Jobs Eat program for a while. That program is gone. The clock is ticking. It's winding down. There's very little for us to offer in terms of incentives anymore. But at the same time, they're continue to compete and fight for our businesses. And I hope that answers your question a little bit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more question. On 2008 was the last year we provided any money for border cities. In 2010, we did not. And so whether or not there'll be a new round of allocation, I don't know. But if there isn't, how would Taylor, is there something in the bill? There's some cities now that currently get that have some reserves. They've got money in reserves that they haven't used yet for the program. So what is your intention, or maybe the bill says, I don't know for sure, if there is not a new allocation, what happens with the dollars? Is there going to be then dollars for Taylor Falls or not?
Yeah, I can answer that from my perspective. I think Mayor Mike probably would have a better answer, but let me kick it off. I know that Mayor Mike would like to give away free land. They have a business park that they are developing. They purchased the land using a partnership with the private sector, Xcel Energy. So they do have some economic incentive currently, but they would like to ramp that up a bit because of the large degree of discrepancy between property taxes in Wisconsin and Taylor's Falls. So that's my answer. I don't know, Mike, if you'd like to.
Madam Chair, members, the property that we have right now, which is 10 acres, it produces absolutely no revenue. We own the land. You're not getting any tax money off from it. Neither am I. And so by developing this property, it's new revenue. And that's what I've been searching for. I've been telling my residents, it's not just about making cuts. It's about finding new revenue dollars. And that's exactly what we're attempting to do. And we're moving in that direction.
Madam Chair, if I could add to that.
Representative Barrett.
Sure. In regarding what this does is it allocates $100,000 for use by the city of Taylor's Falls for a business park or business economic development zone. Unlike what we're doing currently with the cities on the western border, this actually would not be used until and unless there is a business that comes across the border to build a building on that site. It would be used for property tax abatement or a rebate, whereas what the money is used for now is it's just given to the district or that border zone for property tax relief, I believe. So this is a little bit different. The money will not be used until a property comes over. And the fiscal note for this is only $11,000 per year. So it's a pretty small investment for what could be a fairly large improvement in the economic development of Taylor's Falls.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Any other discussion, members? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know which one of the testifiers here. I've got about two or three questions here. You spoke to the 17 businesses that are in Osceola, or have apparently you alluded to the fact that they moved from Minnesota. I think it was one of the other representatives that alluded to the fact that they moved from Minnesota to Wisconsin. Where do their employees live, and what were the wages of those particular companies that moved from Minnesota to Wisconsin?
Mr. Ng?
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, thank you. A lot of the employees that are that work at these companies that relocated are still based in Minnesota, so we still have the opportunity to, you know, have them live in Minnesota. But the disadvantage is for us, it's when we're looking at our commercial and industrial market values for Chisago County, we're probably one of the lowest counties in the state in terms of our commercial market values, because 2 out of 3 people that live in our county commute outside of our county to work every day. A lot of them are commuting to Minneapolis, St. Paul. And that's actually affecting our local downtown businesses. Our businesses downtown are really having a tough time making a go of it, because, quite honestly, people aren't shopping locally anymore. They're shopping on the way back from the Twin Cities every day. They're shopping in, you know, the areas where they work. If they need a chiropractic exam during the day, they're going to go to the chiropractor in Osceola. They're not going to come back to Taylor's Falls where they live and then go back to work that same day, same with the dentist appointment. And so a lot of our businesses on Main Street are really having a tough time making a go of it, and especially with the price of gas continuing to increase, it's going to really put a damper on our ability to keep those businesses downtown alive. We're going to have a tough time in the next couple of years, we think. The construction cost for a business to expand is going to be exactly the same as it is in Taylor's Falls versus Osceola. The materials are the same. The labor is the same. The real advantage that they have is the tax advantage just 200 feet across the river.
Madam Chair.
Senator Mahoney.
So do you know the wages of those companies that have moved from Minnesota to Wisconsin?
I not specifically. Sorry. I can certainly get that. I just don't have it at my fingertips today.
Senator Mahoney.
Madam Chair. Representative Baird, you alluded to the fact that this only comes into play if a company moves from Wisconsin to Minnesota. Was that your intent of the bill, or?
Representative Baird.
Maybe you misspoke, because that would not make a lot of sense to me.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, what I meant to say is we have a business park currently that is being owned by the city of Taylor Falls. So the money that would be used for economic development will not be used unless a new business comes into that park. So it would not be used for an existing business, but one that isn't currently here that we want to attract here, knowing that the city of St. Croix Falls is 220 feet away and has all kinds of commercial, industrial, retail, and people have moved there because of the tax advantages. That's what I meant to say.
Thank you.
Anything else, Representative Mahoney? Representative Dietrich?
Thank you, Madam Chair. To any of the testifiers, would you please correct me if I'm wrong so I don't go down this path of asking some more questions with a false presumption. Did I hear you correctly in saying that the biggest difference right now, at least what you see, is the between the property taxes in Wisconsin and Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, I believe that is the biggest difference right now. And if you look at the information that I handed out, it's about half in St. Croix Falls what the property tax would be in Minnesota.
Half. Mm-hmm.
Representative Dietrich?
Yes, then a follow-up. Just out of curiosity, does Taylor's Falls receive any of the, what we'd call, property tax reduction tools, like fiscal disparities, LGA? I'm trying to think of some others, market value, homestead credit, some of those things that we have tried to use in the past to alleviate some of these discrepancies?
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. Yes, the city does receive the market value and LGA. So, and we have had reductions in that, as all cities with a population of over 1,000 have.
Representative Dietrich?
I really empathize with your situation. And so after being here for 7 years, though, I just get so tired of the yin and yang type movement. It's take away LGA and or cut LGA and market value so we can give Taylor's Falls a special provision to help their economic development while the rest, you know, other areas of the state still suffer. And especially when we then demonize things like LGA and fiscal disparities and those types of things, is that they pick winners and losers. So it's just, it all becomes just a very complex puzzle, but I do empathize with the what the situation Taylor's Falls finds it in, because we do want Minnesota to be competitive. And so I think the challenge for us too is how do we reduce property taxes? And we are in a situation where it isn't just Taylor's Falls that is finding the property taxes onerous. Every homeowner, every small business, every large business is. And as Representative Marquardt has pointed out several times, we've had several proposals in the past 3 years, 4 years, to try to reduce, to make meaningful reduction to property taxes. And so I hope that we can continue down that path and look creatively at that situation. And there are also other things. Well, then I have one follow-up question. In your property taxes, do you have any idea how much of your property tax burden is borne by your school district? Sometimes we don't talk about that enough here in property taxes, because our schools are in the same situation, is that a lack of state funding, all the tools that we have given the state to try to help alleviate and equalize some of these things, and then it just hasn't been working for us, obviously, in the last 6-7 years also. Do you have any idea how much of your property taxes is borne by the schools?
Or Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Ng.
Representative, I do. And in fact, on the property tax comparison spreadsheet that I have submitted, if you look at the building valued at $588,000, the total tax would be $23,313. Of that, $3,000 is a school and some very small miscellaneous taxes.
Okay. Representative Dietrich?
thank you. And just one last comment, Madam Chair, if I may. As a part of the Small Business Caucus, we actually surveyed small businesses, and they did talk about the fact that property taxes are their most onerous tax. And if we could do anything at the state, that would be their preference, would be to reduce property taxes. But as a result of that also, I just want to point out, just so that we can all kind of look forward to it, we did pass a bill on behalf of small businesses, and what we are doing is taking comparisons of different small businesses and their startup costs and comparing them, Minnesota to Wisconsin, so that we can have, we are really truly comparing apples to apples, and we can really try to focus in and find out where are some of the disparities in trying to start up different types of business in Iowa, Wisconsin versus Minnesota, and hopefully we can all get on the same page and say that we need to fix it for actually the whole state to be competitive. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, if I could, Representative Dietrich, just to follow up on your thoughts, I agree with you totally regarding the disparity we have in our state, especially regarding business property taxes with other states. It is not just a Taylor's Falls issue. I represent pretty much the whole county of Chisago, and we have many businesses, as I mentioned last week in testimony, that we have bakeries going under, the new one in Taylor's Falls, another one that just went under. We have video stores, we have manufacturing, we have all kinds of places in our county. Unfortunately, this bill will not help them, and so I want to help them. This is one piece of a larger puzzle that you and I share in our need and desire to reduce the burden. I believe, and I could be wrong, Representative Marquardt might know for sure, but I believe other cities that have tapped into this border city development money also receive LGA and other tax credits. So this would not be a unique situation to our city. This just helps us with a tremendous disparity we currently have with a city that's 220 feet away from our city limit.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted a quick follow-up on Representative Mahoney's question to the testifiers concerning this tax rebate for new companies be moving in. I'm assuming that that rebate would go to Minnesota companies who might move from a different part of the state of Minnesota to your industrial park. Would that be correct?
Madam Chair, members.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you. Yes, that certainly is available to them, and I've been asked before, do you think you're going to be drawing businesses from neighboring cities? And if you compare our tax rate to our neighboring cities, I wish I had their tax rates, because their tax rate is in the 40s. So I'm not too concerned about drawing businesses from local communities. It's Wisconsin. I'm targeting Wisconsin. They've targeted us. I'm targeting them.
Well, Madam Chair, it seems that that was one of the problems with the Jobs Z. One part of the state attracting businesses from another part of the state. And, you know, we're supposed to have a free marketplace here, and it seems like I understand and I'm sympathetic with your problem. I agree with Representative Dietrich and Mark Wirt that we need a more general solution to this problem, but it does seem that we're getting into the process again of picking winners and losers in a marketplace, aren't we, here within our own state? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize if this already came up. Mr. Mayor, my memory is that in the last biennium or the previous, because you've been here before, Representative Marquardt's division report, in fact, recognized this problem that you're raising. I think at that time it was not only framed as kind of competitive business issues, but also public safety for folks like me who come to your beautiful area and spend time there, and it's gorgeous. And my memory is that we gave you an increase in LGA permanently for this problem. Is that not accurate?
Madam Chair, members, thank you for that question. I believe you're referring to the $30,000 allocated for emergency services that we provide to the Interstate State Park. And what happened was that dollar amount is not an amount that is above the LGA amount. What happened was the language allowed it to be blended into the LGA formula, and the money disappeared. So if you said, are you receiving a larger amount because of that, the answer is, I'm not. If LGA goes away completely, and I'm still receiving $30,000, then I'll say, now I'm actually getting my money. But for now, no increase.
Representative Lucheski?
Well, Madam Chair, you know, and I understand how it feels that way as the legislature continues to cut LGA, but I think within the pie of LGA, your area got an additional slice of the pie to recognize this problem, an adjustment on the formula. In fact, I recall on the House floor, folks kind of went crazy that we were providing this relief to your community. So I think members should just know that. I guess, Representative Barrett, I just would say to you, I've been a huge supporter of tax relief for border cities. I think it is a legitimate issue. Most of the 854 cities or whatever there are in this state don't have the issues you do, and I think Representative Marquardt was talking about the western border of the state. And so I understand, you know, what's going on, I think, in your community, and I think we've had this border city aid to recognize that problem, and I think you're trying to address this further. I guess, you know, in the time of tight money, you're looking for a state solution. You're looking for state revenue in your bill to assist in this regard. Have you considered instead, and I hate to even let this committee start thinking about this for a while because everybody else will have a bill, have you thought about trying to reduce the CI, if this is about businesses, a bill that will reduce the classification rate for commercial industrial properties in your area instead of at the rate they pay down to 1%. Now, it wouldn't cost the state any money, so that's the kind of a zero bill that can maybe get through the legislature because you don't have to find money in a deficit. On the other hand, you would be having to take the responsibility of that shift in burden would fall on your residents, and what I heard in the testimony is your residents want to be able to compete for these jobs and get these businesses back. It seems that it'd be a good trade for them. Have you considered that kind of a concept?
Madam Chair, Representative Lincheski, I have not. Well, I have considered the high tax rate that commercial industrial pay in our state and would love to work with you to reduce commercial industrial rates throughout all of Minnesota because this is not unique to Taylor's Falls. I grew up in the town called Brandon, South Dakota, 5 miles inside of the Minnesota border. And 5 miles on the other side is Laverne, Minnesota. Brandon now has a thriving industrial park with many, many companies coming from Laverne and other places. Laverne Truck and Equipment, the year I graduated from high school, was the first one coming over. So I'm aware of this issue, have been for many, many years, even prior to my current position. I would love to work with you to reduce the property tax rates and our businesses pay in our state.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, but before I do that, just so everyone on the committee knows that there's been 3 bakeries, 1 hardware store, and a couple of grocery stores in my district that have gone under. I'm not blaming Wisconsin. Is this bill heading towards jobs and economic development? Because it certainly has, when you're creating an industrial park and competing from one side of the river to another side of the river, certainly has implications and ramifications on how we do jobs and economic development in this state. So do you have any intent to bring it to the Jobs Committee?
Representative Barrett.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, I would defer to the chair and the process for where this bill would go to next. Being 8 weeks into my job, I guess I'm not the person to ask regarding that question.
Representative Mahoney, I think we certainly could make a motion to send it to economic development.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Any other discussion? Okay. I'm going to withdraw the previous motion and move that House File 112 be referred to the Economic Development Committee. And I guess any discussion on that? Did you get the vote?
Yeah.
Okay. Any discussion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Same sign. Okay. Representative Barrett?
If I could just
final comment?
Quick comment. I'd just like to recognize Chisago County Commissioner Rick Green, who is also here attending and is very interested in making sure that this bill goes forward. So thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. Motion prevails on House File 112. And we are now looking at House File 680. And the chair moves that House File 680 be brought before the committee. And that is Representative Biskins. Good morning, sir.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair. Committee members, thank you very much. Madam Chair, members, House File 680 is, I believe, a pretty simple bill, fairly non-controversial from what I understand. I will leave the controversial stuff today, Madam Chair, for Representative Winchesky, and I appreciate her doing that for me. Madam Chair, House File 680, I think, is a commitment that has been made throughout the campaign season about fundamental reform and transparency. Madam Chair, I want to applaud you for allowing this bill to come up for testimony, because that is a mantra that we heard from one side of the aisle throughout the campaign season. And Madam Chair, you are fulfilling your campaign promises to look at fundamental reform and creating transparency in government, and I appreciate you doing that. Much, Madam Chair, the way I appreciate the governor for what he's doing, to be perfectly honest. He said he was going to tax the bejeekers out of people, and he's keeping that promise. And it's not always easy promises to make once you're elected, but you're keeping your promise. This bill basically says if you're going to tax the people of the state of Minnesota, you should do it in the most transparent means possible. We created a shadow government, Madam Chair, called Regional Rail Authorities, and then we gave them taxing authority. We gave them levy authority. Madam Chair, we are truly concerned about relieving property tax burdens on the people who can afford them the least, because heard over and over again that property taxes are incredibly regressive. If we're truly concerned about relieving that burden, well, one way to do that is to let the people who are being taxed have the greatest transparency in how they're being taxed. And Madam Chair, this bill takes away the taxing authority from the regional rail authorities, but it does not take away the authority to tax for regional rail authority purposes, which can still be done at the county board level in open meetings. So, Madam Chair, pretty simple concept. Members, if you have any questions, I'll stand for them. But, Madam Chair, I do want to throw out one kudos to Mr. Bill Schreiber, a lobbyist who did come up and tell me that he had concerns and would like to speak to those concerns, Madam Chair. So that's the only opposition I'm aware of, and I'm sure that most of the lobbyists anyway understand protocol, and if they had concerns, they'd come see me before the committee. So I don't assume we'll be hearing concerns from anyone anyone else, Madam Chair. But thank you.
Representative Biskins, I think there are a couple of others who wish to testify.
And didn't talk to me.
So, let's see. Any questions from the committee of Representative Biskins? All right. Any opposition then? We'll maybe call on Mr. Schreiber then first. Mr. Schreiber? Did you wish to speak, Mr. Schreiber, against this bill? I'm sorry. Okay. Then we have Keith Carlson from the Inter-County Association.
Madam Chair, if you could permit the county commissioners here first to go, I believe Matt Look and Nancy Schulong are here, and I will follow them.
All right. Mr. Look. Good morning. Give us your name and who you represent, please, for the record.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Matt Look. I'm an Anoka County Commissioner. I am a chair of the Regional Rail Authority in Anoka County. I'm also chair of the Finance Committee, and I think this bill kind of impacts both of those areas. I have with me here today the Mayor of Ramsey, and with your permission, Madam Chair, there's a portion I'd like him to speak to on this. I am here to testify in opposition to 680. And I do want to make it clear that these comments are my position on this. The board has not had an opportunity to formally address this bill and or, you know, write a resolution. As I understand, 680 would limit the repayment of bonds taken out after April 1st, 2011. Taxes could be levied for repayment of, as it says, GO bonds prior to that date. In 2007, for history, Anoka County bonded $32 million for our share of a local match of Phase 1 of North Star. The problem here is that we sold special limit tax bonds, which are, although similar to general obligation bonds, are technically different. And so committee members may know that Anoka County has a AAA bond rating. We've been very fiscally diligent in maintaining that bond rating, and we certainly wouldn't want to jeopardize that bond rating with a technicality such as this. The second issue that's perhaps equally as important is that of the investments we've made so far in efforts to increase ridership on the North Star line and economic development around the stations. I think the number one goal of the Anoka County Regional Rail Authority is, and the NCDA, or the North Star Corridor Development Authority, is to increase ridership. Phase 2 is currently on hold right now for the purpose of increasing ridership, and at which point, you know, they're going to pursue with possible federal dollars for that portion of it. But substantial investments have been made in efforts to increase ridership. If we do that, if we succeed in that, we reduce subsidies, and we help to make the North Star meet its projections as of January. North Star is meeting its projections up 19%, so we're happy to report that. Mayor Ramsey is going to speak a little bit on economic development, but again, I think increasing ridership will help to reduce public subsidy in this project. Economic development and taxes generated around those stations will offset operating costs and repay public investment on this project to date. The taxpayer has invested a lot of money, $317 million in the North Star project, and I don't personally believe that this bill represents the taxpayer's ability to recoup that investment to date. So. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Bob Ramsey, the mayor of the city of Ramsey. My concern with this is obviously the Ramsey station. Our goal here is to be able to create that economic development around the Ramsey Town Center, which, of course, the city ended up purchasing out of bankruptcy to recoup our investment of over $12 million in infrastructure that was already in the ground when it went to, when it went bankrupt. I see this as maybe taking away one possibility of funding that stop. That was my opposition to it. I don't want to see our ability to be able to get that stop and create the economic development that's going to happen with that stop. Currently have about $80 million worth of development that will happen with this station, private development, not subsidized development.
Okay, Representative Peterson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Commissioner Look, Mayor, what do you see as the practical end result of this becoming law?
Mr. Look.
Well, as I again, as I understand, I think the language is limiting in terms of our repayment of bonds. Certainly, we don't want to be put in a position where we're going to have that technical difficulty in repaying those bonds with levied tax dollars. I don't know if this is aimed at upstart projects and other rail projects. The reality is the North Star is here. Mm-hmm. It's on the ground. We paid for it. We've already prepaid our right-of-way cost to BNSF. I think the issue for us here is to make it successful. If we can increase ridership, we can reduce subsidy. If we can bring in development, taxes generated from that that might not otherwise be there, offsets what the public has invested in this, I think we all succeed in the process. If we try and limit the activities that regional rail authorities do, for example, we fund a North Star commuter coach service, which brings riders to the train. We are obviously interested in participating financially from a county standpoint in the Ramsey Station. And there's many other initiatives that we do and spend money on to try and maintain this ridership and make it a successful project. Taking away our tools, if you will, to do that, I think torpedoes the whole thing. And if that's the goal, I don't know that that serves the taxpayer well at this point for the investments already made in it.
Representative, Mr. Peterson?
Well, I tend to agree with you. I mean, I think it's been 2 years since North Star has been in full operation, and it has been a substantial, $317 million is what you said investment, and it may be somewhat irresponsible to pull back, even if it is heavily subsidized. I do have a question as it relates to that, though. What is the subsidy? I think it's $3.80 is what the gentleman from the Inter-County Association said from Big Lake to Minneapolis. What's the true cost of that? What is the subsidy that goes along with the ridership fee?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that somewhere in the $20 to $25 a trip, depending on where you're coming from, it could be anywhere from $6 to $4 for a ride. So it is heavily subsidized. I think roads are heavily subsidized. Buses are heavily subsidized. But we do subsidize transit options. I think the important thing to note is that not necessarily being there to have advocated for it initially, but the reality is that it takes 1,000 riders off of a Highway 10 congested corridor. That's a dysfunctional morning commute. If we ultimately, this is getting off topic, but if we ultimately stop a North Star project, those drivers are going to be back on that road, and I think it's a conservative estimate to upgrade Highway 10 at this point into Minneapolis is a mere $1.2 billion. So we have a serious financial issue here if we try and limit our transit options. I'm not saying it's the most efficient project out there. I wouldn't say that at this point, but the goal is to get to that point, and I think by increasing ridership, we at least have that option of trying to grow it.
Senator Peterson?
And this will be my last question. What's wrong with Anoka County just levying the money directly and having a line item on their tax statement?
We do.
Rather than the regional rail authority being the the central governing body, I guess.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure how it was set up initially, but I know on the tax statement, I believe the average house right now pays about $30 a year for the regional rail authority levy. This is, there was an issue of transparency. This is all done in open meetings, public information on this. I don't know how the statement is that it's not transparent, but
and I'm not making that statement. I'm just asking the question. Yep. Okay.
Mr. Ramsey.
Madam Chair, I'd argue that it is more transparent this way. When I look at my tax statement, I see my property tax statement. I see $30 or $40, $50 for regional rail authority, depending on the cost of your house. If you bury it into Anoka County government funding, general funding or levy, that's less open to me than being able to actually see a line item on my tax bill.
Mm-hmm. All right, Representative Peterson.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Biskins, did you want to comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and there are a number of things that I want to comment on. Number one is the repayment of bonds. There clearly is some language left in the bill that allows for the repayment of bonds. Chasing some, we're not sure about a technicality, is a way to say, don't make any changes. All right. Let's not look at any reform. because, you know, there might be something behind some little rock out in some desert island that could throw everything off. All right, so I think that's a white elephant. Number two, you heard in testimony of the two gentlemen that the need for this is because we want to increase ridership. The need for this is because we need to offset operating costs. Representative, you heard in testimony, it went kind of quick. Let's reiterate. The latest estimates are about $50 subsidy per round trip. $50 in subsidies per round trip. And we need to recoup our investments. That's what we heard. We need to recoup our investments. But how do you recoup your investments when you need the money just for operations? Right? We've got a hole here. It's maybe time we should stop digging. At the end of the day, I don't know how many people know where the regional rail authorities meet, how to get on their agenda, when their meeting times are. Right? Yeah, we're real transparent when you can't even go to express your concerns. It's out there. It is. But people look at government and say, I've got city, I've got county, I've got state, I've got federal. They don't look and say, oh yeah, I've got regional rail authority, I've got watershed districts, I've got the Metropolitan Council, I've got mosquito control district. All of those things are nickel and diming our property taxpayers. Say, well, this isn't much, this is just a little bit. But all those little bits add up to where we are hearing a revolt throughout this state that our property taxpayers are being hammered again and again and again. If we're looking for reform, then let's look for transparency. Let's look, if it's a county tax, let's have the county boards make that levy, and then the people know directly who to go to when they have concerns with the levy going up and up and up.
Mr. Look?
Madam Chair, if I can respond to that. Our levy, I don't know if you've seen the documentation on this, but our levy has been going down. The Anoka County Regional Rail Authority consists of all county board members, so all votes taken to increase or lower levy is by the county board members. To the point of the investment, my understanding is if we kill North Star at this point, we need to refund approximately $160 million to the FTA for not using or in breach of contract. So I guess if that's the ultimate goal here, we'd probably need to find a funding source for $160 million on top of it. In addition to that, the agreement with BNSF for the right-of-way, if we don't use the lines for a period of 2 years, we forfeit that right of $107 million prepaid for that right-of-way for 100 years. We forfeit that. So I'm not sure that, you know, the road that we're down, we can back out of at this point without huge cost. But let's try and make, you know, I guess a good way of looking at it is we have a lot of lemons here. Let's try and make some lemonade out of it and make this project work. And that's what we're committed to in Anoka County. We've identified Ramsey as an area of economic development. The town center there is, full build-out, 3,900 jobs, tax base. If you calculate that into it, yes, you have expenditure on this end, but you have revenue on this end, and I think it'll work. So,
Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple thoughts and then a question for the testifiers. Regarding the ridership for North Star, I understand it to be, I don't know if I'd use the word inflated, but it certainly went up during a period when the Twins were playing and getting sellout crowds of 40,000 people to their new stadium. And so a lot of the ridership, when it was above projection, it was during that period of time in summer and late summer. And so, which is fine, I think. I think, you know, at 7 o'clock at night, maybe there's not a need for that level of service. Generally speaking, the roads are fairly clear at that point. We don't have a lot of traffic jams at 7 or 10 o'clock at night. I think that's important to note as we look at how it reduces the congestion on the road. And you had mentioned we have 1,000 people that would be driving in a car compared to them, would be driving in a car. What has that done to decrease the amount of traffic on the road during rush hour? What does that 1,000 cars represent as a percentage of all traffic on either 10 or 94? And then another thought, I guess, in summary is regarding the Highway 10 improvements that we apparently may not need to make of $1.2 billion. There are some improvements being made in Ramsey. I know that because a couple of businesses have been closed, a couple of restaurants, or at least one restaurant I know of, has been closed to widen the lanes. So I think the issues I would have is the cost of doing both and whether that increases the cost, and what's the advantage of having that inflated cost and the degree to which that helps our road traffic. So I think I had one question in that regard, but you could, sir.
Mr. Look.
Madam Chair, to respond, there's three areas that I want to comment on. First of all, the ridership was boosted up as a result of the Twins games. Met Council provides numbers from December to January. December to January was a 19% increase. So as the Twins weren't playing, I believe that's a result of people trying the line, experiencing the fact that they don't have congestion, experiencing the fact that they can get some work done on the train while going into work. I think people find that that although it's hard to change habits, that there is some benefits to using this, and we're seeing an increase in ridership on that. The businesses that were purchased on Highway 10 was part of a RALF program, Right-of-Way Acquisition Loan Fund. As you may be aware, the MnDOT has pulled back on any expenditures of right-of-way acquisition loan funds right now, so that project, that freeway Highway 10 to freeway project, is on hold right now, and we're not sure to what extent. From a city standpoint, as a former city council member, I can say that we're disappointed in learning that, because all those properties are taken off the tax rolls, high-paying commercial properties, and we don't know what the future is on that. We can't recoup those taxes. So that's a problem definitely for the city. There is an estimate that for every 50 riders, it accounts for a quarter lane mile of less traffic. North Star currently moves 1,000 people in the morning and 1,000 people in the evening. In effect, there's a minimum of 5 lane miles taken out only in the rush hour time period. That's morning, that's evening. So imagine driving down Highway 10 trying to get onto 35W and adding 5 more lane miles of traffic into that scenario. I think it, I would have to say, it would create a more dysfunctional community.
Representative Barrett.
Madam Chair, thank you. Sir, I'd have to chew on that one. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but on my ride home tonight, I will ponder that. So if you could tell me, though, how many cars drive on 10 and 94 in the morning currently? As it relates to the 1,000 that were taken off, if you know that number?
I don't know that number.
Madam Chair,
Mr.
I believe Highway 10 is about 33,000 cars per day. So, taken.
Actually, I believe it's 100,000. So maybe we can get our numbers correct.
33.6 is the information I had.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Representative Barrett.
So if 33.6 currently go on Highway 10 and probably an equal number or more on 94, which is another mode of transportation from Big Lake and Monticello and St. Cloud, then we would be reducing traffic by 1%, I believe, if the numbers are correct, potentially, with the ridership on the North Star. Is that...
Representative, or Mr. Luck.
And Madam Chair, are we referring to just rush hour or all day long?
Representative Barrett.
I think we're referring to the point in time in which the 1,000 riders are taking the train and moving from one destination to another.
Well, we know that because it's a commuter rail line that it's only during rush hour periods. That's when we have the primary problem on Highway 10. Congestion is the greatest at that point. So any efforts to remove that congestion, I would think is good. Now, looking at the cost of it, obviously, is something to take in consideration.
Madam Chair, if I could. Question I would have is, to what extent does North Star diminish or reduce the amount of traffic during those high peak periods? And I'm wondering if it's close to 1% or 1.5% or 2. If we could find that answer, I think that would be good for us to know.
Thank you. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much. This is why I'm glad I never was a member of the Transportation Committee. But I'd like to bring it back to some property tax things, and I'm not real familiar with these regional rail authorities, and so maybe staff, if they could, when was this legislation originally authorized, and then how do these regional rail authorities get their authority to levy taxes? I don't know if someone could answer that.
Mr. Hines, did you want to address that?
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, I don't want to address it because I don't know the answer. I think they've certainly been around for a good, 20 years, okay. And I think possibly longer. My recollection is that one of the reasons they were created was at a time when a lot of the rail lines were being abandoned. There was some effort to put a mechanism in place for governments to possibly retain some of those lands before they were sold off, but...
Madam,
Ms. Dalt,
Ms. Dalton has just pointed out that in the statute, it looks like there's the first reference we see to the regional rails is in 1980.
Okay.
So,
and Madam Chair, that's have some background information. excuse me. The law was established in 1980, and going through some paperwork here, I see a number of the authorities were created in 1987. That includes Dakota County, Washington County, and Hennepin County.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, I'm looking at the bill on page one, and all, everything's deleted, which it looks like people had the ability to vote on whether or not to give these regional rails authority, or am I not reading this correctly? I mean, how do they get the ability to levy property taxes?
Mr. Hines?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Markwart, the language you see being stricken on page one is actually a reverse referendum. I believe that the statute gives counties authority to create a regional rail authority and with some levy authority if they choose to act, and then this is a reverse referendum through a petition, voters would ask to have that put before a vote. But
I got you. Very good.
Okay, Representative Peterson.
I'll pass.
Okay. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think kind of my question has been answered. First of all, how many rail authorities do we have? And I'm assuming that none of these rail authorities are elected officials. I have a question, and whoever can answer that. So,
Mr. Luck.
Madam Chair, again, our rail authority consists of all county board members. So I can't speak to the other counties. I would assume it's very similar.
Do we have staff picking that up, Mr. Hines?
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, your packets, you do have a little sheet of the amount of levy by regional rail authorities in the last 2 years, and you'll see there's 11 authorities listed. Now, this is just for 2 years. I don't know if in the past there may have been some other ones or not, but my sense is this is about the number we do usually have. Most of the metro counties and a few outstate counties.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Detmer's question and the response by testifier, yeah, and it's my understanding that most of the regional rail authority members are elected county board members. Right? Well, for goodness sakes, right? Talk about transparency. Nobody is elected to a regional rail authority. They're county board members. And yet you can point to your tax statement and say, well, this isn't a county tax. This is a real regional rail authority tax. Who's responsible for that? And you have to go dig. And that's not the kind of transparency we should look for. If they're county board members, then put it on the county tax roll. That's all I'm saying.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hate to divert this conversation again, but just because North Star is a part of my district, I really feel like I need to speak to some of the comments that were made and just remind members where we were at 7 years ago with the whole North Star discussion and how it became about, because there were some things just said here that I think just need to be redirected a little bit. First of all is that, you know, there was some conversation about Highway 10 when we analyzed the Highway 10 corridor. That was one of the busiest corridors in the nation and most congested. When we looked at the cost benefit of whether it would be smarter to add a lane or to go to the North Star commuter rail when there was already existing rail there, that North Star commuter rail was the most cost efficient way to address that corridor. The most important thing I think for that on that topic is the North Star coming to Anoka County, there was a 70% approval rating with the public that they wanted that corridor and they wanted rail instead of another lane of highway. And I just want to also then remind people that when North Star opened, the whole state was in unison, or I shouldn't say in unison, there were probably some people who were not, but very supportive of the project, very proud of bringing that to Anoka County. And there were people like Governor Pawlenty and Speaker Swigum just extremely proud of that project and bringing the state forward. And then so now to say that, even to misconstrue this, that we're trying to increase ridership because it's a lemon, I don't agree with that. I think that is just a good business practice. Everybody gets into the business that they are, and it is to increase their business. And that is a daily, yearly goal that you have to have. Otherwise, you will be out of business. And so the whole increasing ridership is just smart business management, and it will always be part of the goal of North Star. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Any other discussion, members? We have a couple of other testifiers. Nancy Schuweiler.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome, and please give us your name and who you represent for the record.
Morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Dakota County Commissioner Nancy Schuweiler. That's spelled S-C-H-O-U-W-E-I-L-E-R. I'm here on behalf of the Dakota County Regional Rail Authority. I am the chair of the Dakota County Legislative Work Group, and I am the vice chair of the county board. Transit plays an increasingly important role in moving people across our state and region. Highway funding is increasingly directed at necessary projects to preserve our pavements and maintain safe bridges. This leaves little funding for important highway expansion projects in the Twin Cities region, resulting in congestion and reduced mobility. Transit investment is one way to help maintain our mobility and ensure that Twin Cities residents have options to increasing congestion. In many areas within the Twin Cities, it's not possible to build highways wide enough to alleviate this congestion. For example, the Cedar Avenue Bridge over the Minnesota River cannot be built wide enough to meet the traffic demands. In the MnDOT 2030 plan, there is no increase in capacity for Cedar Avenue. The Cedar Avenue Bus Rapid Transitway in Dakota and Hennepin counties will accommodate enough riders to provide up to an additional half lane of capacity during rush hour through the express and station-to-station service by late 2012. The Cedar Avenue Bus Rapid Transitway is designated buses run on the highway shoulder. Dakota County is the lead agency for implementation of the Cedar Avenue Bus Rapid Transitway. Counties have long been leaders in the development and implementation of transit options in the region, from assisting in provision of express and regular route service through opt-out transit providers to development of regional transitway projects such as the Hiawatha LRT, the North Star Commuter Rail, and the Cedar Avenue Bus Rapid Transitways. Without these county regional rail authorities, we would not have these transit lines today. In this region, counties, acting through their regional rail authorities, are responsible for undertaking feasibility studies and alternative analysis studies that develop the transitway projects. Along with the responsibility to lead these studies comes the responsibility to complete them. Counties are also responsible for 10% of the cost of transitway capital investments. These costs are paid for by the Regional Rail Authority levy. Without the local share to fund these portions of transitway projects, we would severely limit or eliminate our ability to leverage federal, state, and regional funds to implement these transitway improvements and further diminish already limited resources available for these purposes. Regional Rail Authority's funds have attracted over $950 million in federal funds through competitive process. The Central Corridor will leverage another $450 million of competitive federal funds. We see this as a wise investment of local tax dollars. Dakota County is proud of our fiscal management and quality service that we provide our citizens. In fact, we have the lowest property tax rate in the state. We are also pleased that we are implementing bus rapid transit on Cedar Avenue as a cost-effective, flexible alternative to more costly highway and bridge expansion or light rail transit. Without the Regional Rail Authority levy, we would once again be looking to the county property tax levy. The Regional Rail Authority levy provides transparency and a source of funding for very specific purposes. Again, despite being a different levy, we are very fiscally aware of the impact these levies have on our citizens as the locally elected officials setting the levy. We are accountable to the taxpayers for every cent. This is an example of local government meeting the needs of its citizenry. All the Regional Rail Authority meetings are posted and comply with the open meeting law. They are listed on our website, and in Dakota County, they all follow our regularly scheduled county board meetings. For taxes payable in 2011, our actual Dakota County Regional Rail Authority levy is $1.641 million. We are levying only 8% of the regional rail levy amount permitted under state law. Let me repeat that. We are levying only 8% of the regional rail levy amount permitted under state law. For these reasons, I wish to speak in opposition of the proposed legislation that would eliminate Regional Rail Authority levy and bonding authority. I ask you to continue to provide us with the fiscal tools to best do our jobs as elected officials that provide our county's products and services using the most fiscally responsible and transparent taxation methods possible, including retention of the Regional Rail Authority levy and bonding powers. In return, I can assure you that Dakota County will continue with our tradition of fiscally prudent services, including effective and efficient transportation solutions.
Thank you. Representative Biskins?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I want to state once again that we are not taking away levy authority. We're just putting it back to the county board. We're taking away another layer of government. Let's understand that. You heard in the testimony that there's a lot of money being levied for transitways, busways, rapid transit, etc., and yet it's under the guise of a regional rail authority. That's transparency? Of course it isn't. All right. If that's what your aim is, then do it as the county board. Talked about how much federal money regional rail authorities have been able to garner, and the testifiers talked about the $450 million in federal funds for Central Corridor. Understand, members, that the state of Minnesota and the counties involved have spent over $130 million already in Central Corridor. There's a lawsuit currently underway by the businesses along University Avenue, and the federal government has not yet released the $450 million for Central Corridor, and there's some question as to whether or not they will reauthorize that money, which they must do if it is not done in short order. So we could be left holding the bag for a heck of a lot of money our taxpayers are going to have to pay because of some promises that haven't come through yet. Members, again, we're not talking about getting rid of the ability to tax. We're not talking about getting rid of Central Corridor. We're not talking about getting rid of North Star or Hiawatha. They're here to stay. We're simply talking about getting rid of some pseudo-shadow government entity that has levy and taxing authority and give the authority back to where the people understand it should ought to be, which is at the county level.
Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, if I may respond.
Ms.
The legislature provided the authority for the counties to create the regional rail authorities. We have separate meetings, a separate levy, a separate accounting, separate budget, and it is very transparent. Everything that happens for transit in our county happens through the Regional Rail Authority. All that funding, all the tax levy, everything is in one separate budget. I can show you the budget for Dakota County Regional Rail Authority. It's that simple. It's that specific. If we were to include this levy in with the general fund and the general property tax levy, you would have to find it through pages of our budget document. I don't think that's transparency in local government. I think this makes it very specific and very easy for a local taxpayer to find where that line on their tax statement, where that money goes and how it is used. Thank you.
Mr. Carlson,
Madam Chair,
state your name and who you represent, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, whose membership includes several of the regional rail authorities not here today, Sherburne County, Carver County, Stearns County, St. Louis County, and Washington County. I would first suggest to the committee that this is not the venue to debate the appropriateness of rail. That's really the responsibility of the Transportation Committee. I'll further remind the committee that although all the discussion here today has been about commuter rail, regional rail authorities assist both commuter and freight rail. And two of the counties that are currently levying that authority, although I don't represent them, I believe us levying for their purposes right now, Morrison and Itasca County. So if you're concerned about your shippers having access to rail freight when the private railroads are threatening to abandon those right-of-ways, this is the entity that preserves that that transportation resource. I'll just go over a few things and add a few comments. First, to the extent we are talking about commuter rail or light rail, the only way the counties can proceed with using the regional rail authorities to facilitate that is if those transportation facilities are approved by plans of the Department of Transportation and the Metropolitan Council. They can't go it on their own. The taxing authority has already been mentioned, but it bears mentioned again. The regional rail authorities must give notice before they first exercise this authority, and if 5% of the voters petition for a referendum on that, a referendum must be held, and the voters can reject that authority. Their levy authority is strictly limited. It's only 0.04835% of market value. It cannot exceed that amount. As far as transparency goes, this is the only special taxing jurisdiction that is a separate line item on the property tax statement. There is no other special taxing authority that appears as a separate line. They're all lumped together either in Greater Minnesota, every special taxing authority, the watershed districts, the sanitary sewer districts, the HRAs, the port authorities, or within the metro area, there would be a separate line for the metro agencies in addition to the other special taxing districts, but still the regional rail authorities are broken out. Finally mentioned that there is a strict limitation on how much the metro, those five counties in the metro area levying part of the county transportation improvement board can subsidize these projects. They are limited to 10% subsidy of the capital cost of these. So there are a number of limitations within the law. I will finally and respectfully disagree with Representative Diskins. Absent this authority, I do not believe the counties have any authority to levy for rail. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any discussion, members? Representative Crawford?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you address that last point? Why don't the counties have the authority to levy for any subject like rail?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative Crawford, our levy authority comes from statutory grants from the legislature, and to my knowledge, there is no explicit authority for counties acting alone, not through the regional rail authorities, to levy for rail. I would be happy to be corrected by your staff, but I don't believe that authority currently exists.
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, actually that is what I was up here researching right now, and as of right now I cannot find any county authority to levy for this absent the Regional Rail Authority Act.
Mr. Crawford, Representative Crawford. Any further comment? Okay. Any other discussion, members? I'm sorry, Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'd just like to ask how quickly, absent the Railroad Authority, how quickly a state could actually authorize this to the county or other level, or another level of elected government, so as to perform the duties that we are elected to do.
Representative Barrett, I think we could take those actions today or tomorrow. All right. Are there any other testifiers in opposite? Or Representative Biskins, did you wish to respond or final comments?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I thought we were wrapping up, and I just wanted to make a final comment.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead, unless there are other folks in the audience that would like to speak in opposition or in favor. Seeing none, okay, Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and again, committee members. You know, as I stated at the beginning, I want to commend all of the members of this committee for at least looking at reform. Change and reform is difficult. Everything we have in all 15 of those books called the statutes are in there because somebody championed them. And so when you look to make changes and reform, it's going to be hard. But you're doing the hard work, and I want to commend you for that, and I want to thank you, Madam Chair and members, for allowing me the opportunity to present this bill.
Thank you. Was Representative Dietrich?
Yeah, may I just ask one question to Representative Biskins? So, Representative Biskins, in this reform, what I'm kind of gathering now, understanding what your main purpose in bringing this forward and reform, yes, that's wonderful. So do you believe that this reform would reduce property taxes?
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Dietrich. Whether or not it would reduce property taxes, at least it puts the onus of where the property tax is being levied on the people who are levying it. As you heard from the testimony, most of these regional rail authorities are the county boards. And yet the county board gets to go like this when it comes to this levy, discretionary levy, because they said, well, no, that's the look at your tax statement. It's not the county board. It's the Regional Rail Authority. At least, do I believe in the intelligence of the people of the state of Minnesota? I absolutely do. And they'll make a decision when they're given good information and it's clear and transparent.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. At this time, then, the chair is going to move that House File 680 be referred to the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee. Any discussion of that? Representative Biskins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if that's the will of the chair, although I do not believe, as again, this bill is not meant to be hinder transportation in any way, shape, or form, and is solely an issue of the property tax, I do question, but it's up to the will of the chair.
I think we'll move it in that direction, Representative Biskins. So all in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Same sign. Okay. Bill moves to Transportation Committee, House File 680. So, and sort of in respect of the time frame and that a lot of people have come to testify on House File 398, I think we're going to move Representative Chesky to do that next, and maybe we can hear from the folks that came to speak who are not at the Capitol every day and have them at least have their voices heard. So, and the chair moves House File 398 and brings it before the committee. Representative Lemchesky. Do we have an amendment then? The 398 A3 amendment. Mm-hmm. And I'll move that amendment. Do you want to tell us what it does, Representative?
Madam Chair, it just gets the bill in the order. I would like it. We had it. There's another amendment in the folder, and I think we just had a disconnect when I was working with staff last night to get the right amendment in the folder. So the amendment will reflect what the House summary, the research summary says.
Okay. Any discussion of that, members? If seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion, the delete everything. A3 amendment is passed. Representative Lemchesky, you want to tell us about your bill?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I really very sincerely want to thank the Chair for hearing this bill. This is a difficult bill, I think, for people to hear, think about, just So I'm asking members if you can just try to open your mind a little bit here and just think about the big picture of the property tax system in this bill. And the information I have available for you will allow you to get down in the weeds very personally to your district. But I first want to just say in this bill, what I'm really trying to do here, and again, thanking the chair for allowing me to do this, is to get us to begin to zero-based budget in the property tax aids and credit system. You know, we've heard a lot of talk of we really need to look at everything, turn over every rock, we should do zero-based budgeting, we need reform, we have to pick priorities. And so what I'm attempting to do is to sort of throw out the system and use data to help people think, if you were going to redo the system, how would you do it? And so that's what's going on in this bill. We've heard a lot of criticism in this committee the whole time I've been on it, and this year already. You know, these formulas don't work. You can't understand them. You know, is there any sense to them? Who came up with them? What's the spending side? What's the capacity side? They hurt rural Minnesota. They hurt the suburbs. They hurt the urban core. Or they help the wealthy suburbs or hurt the Iron Range or whatever. You know, everybody's got a view, right? So what I'm trying to do is step out of that parochial view for a minute and remove the property tax aid and credit system from the state of Minnesota and see what would happen to property taxes. So that's what this bill does. It takes everything out, whether it's, I won't list them all just off the top of my head here. I refer you actually to the bill. So if you can actually look at the bill's summary, very simply, I think the summary really best defines it. This bill eliminates all aids and credits that are paid to local units of government. So that's removing, you know, local government aid, market value homestead credit, county program aid, fiscal disparities, eliminating these provisions, and retains the direct payments to individuals. We often hear this argument, let's have just payments to individuals and no aids, or let's have just aids and no payments to individuals. I'm throwing out all the aids and credit systems. These are all, you know, money from the state of Minnesota to local units of government. In so doing, I'm enhancing the property tax refund. I'm keeping the payment to individuals through property tax refunds and through renter's credit. I'm additionally removing sort of all the shackles that we hear from local units of government that they're being put under. And so I'm eliminating all maintenance of effort, I'm eliminating levy limits, and I'm allowing for local sales tax options if voters approve them. And so these would be the ideas. You're moving from the state equalizing the tax base to purely local decision making, with the state getting out of the business of having attempts to equalize the tax base. And then, of course, I'm also repealing all the programs that shift tax burdens amongst divisions that are, you know, zero cost on the spreadsheet to the state, but they are absolutely moving tax burdens around. Representative Davids had a bill that did that this morning. So it repeals the Metropolitan Fiscal Disparities Program, the Iron Range Fiscal Disparities Program, the Green Acres Program, Rural Preserves, Metro Ag. So we're just going to, you know, clear the decks of all this stuff that has been brought in over 40 years and say, you know, let's start over. So the bill is attempting to do that. And again, keeping and enhancing the property tax refund system. So I think if you look at the summary on the bottom, starting on the bottom, page 2, and then the page 3, you can see all the things I'm repealing in addition to what I mentioned. PILT payments, taconite aid, disparity reduction aid, property tax or utility transition aid, tribal casino aid, wetlands credit, sustainable forest, bovine TB, aids to police and fire amortization aid. The list just goes on and on and on. And often, you know, our voters don't understand that we have all these programs and these budgets sitting in Representative Runbeck's, Chair Runbeck's committee, that we are using state resources to try to do things for property taxpayers, and it's complicated. So I'm trying to just remove it all. So if you see this, if you look at the summary, you can see what I'm removing. Then if I could refer you to this set of maps. And what this does is this shows what the bill does to the state of Minnesota when you take out all the aids and credits. And we've heard from people, you know, in this legislature and in past years that, you know, all these aids and credits really don't do anything. When you cut local government aid and other aids and credits, there won't be a property tax increase. And I think this map shows that that's probably not accurate. If you repeal all these programs, you can see what will happen. Most of the state, like all of rural Minnesota, will get a 20% property tax increase. And as you look through it, you can look around where will, you know, what will happen to towns, what will happen to the metro, and you can actually see that a subpart of the metro actually does pretty well. When you throw out all aids and credits, there's a small part of the state, I happen to represent it, that does really well when we don't have aids and credits. And I think Representative Benson and I in this room are the only members who, with this bill, actually our residents would get a property tax cut. The rest of the state would see a dramatic tax increase. And so I'm not trying to be parochial to my area. I'm just trying to get the committee here to understand what all these pieces are doing together. And when you remove them, you can absolutely see what happens across the state. And this was done, I talked to the chair about this bill quite a while ago, and I want to thank all the staff, the Department of Revenue, House Research, who've worked. When you put a bill together like this, it takes a lot of nonpartisan work on creating runs and simulations, and so that's all here for you. And these were made by, you know, nonpartisan staff. I should say on that map of the state looking, I think the highest part of the state got 107% tax increase. That was the taconite cities. And the city who did the best, I think, was me. So, I mean, no surprise. I think you can see in part why I'm probably the author who can carry a bill like this. Most legislators can't even carry a bill like this because they have to explain why they were for raising taxes on their residents. This bill actually cuts my residents' taxes. But I'm doing it for us to all see, what does this do to the whole state when we throw out all these systems that people claim, you know, are kind of worthless? I mean, we're hearing a lot of rhetoric about that, and if we cut them, it just doesn't matter. Well, this bill sort of takes up that question in a very serious way. So if you next look at this the actual run, the front page says, I'm sorry, House Research Simulation Report, and it's 40 pages, and I wouldn't ask you to look at all 40 pages, but I would ask you to look at a couple, if I may, Madam Chair. This shows what this bill does to property taxes in the whole state. And I think the easiest way to look at it is to turn to page one that shows the statewide impact. And statewide, this bill would raise property taxes 8.7%. And you can see that kind of middle of the page, there's a total line and a percent change down below. So again, that's statewide, but that's, you know, the Iron Range or the taconite cities having 107% property tax increase and my city getting a tax cut. But that's the range. And then if you look at page two, you can see the effect on greater Minnesota. I think that's a very illustrative page. On the top line, residential homestead existing, it's a 23.7% increase under percentage change in property taxes for greater Minnesota. And if you look at the bottom of the page, you can see low-valued homes, middle, and high. And what you can see by looking at that is the lower value the home is, the higher the property tax increase when you remove all these systems. They absolutely are moving to give more assistance to greater Minnesota and then to the lowest value homes. So the low valued home gets a 38% property tax increase, a middle home 21, high valued 15, and an extra high valued 9%. So, you know, that's one way to read these pieces of paper. The third page is the metro, and you can see that in the metro it is property tax increases, smaller. Definitely smaller. But I think if you page around and actually look at the cities, it's kind of interesting in the areas to see what's going on, you know, with the repeal of Green Acres in the bill. There's just a lot going on in there. But I would turn you to page 30, just so you can kind of see what I'm talking about. Page 30 shows my area, and you can see that my homeowners would pretty much all be getting a property tax cut. And that's, you know, they would have the ability, if you removed all these aids and credits, to levy back their pension aids and their fire aids and take care of their police and fire, and they still could cut people's property taxes. So the net system affects everybody very differently around the state. Then there's two more pieces. This one I asked staff to kind of look at the committee and try to see what it would do in your own area. And I said just don't spend too much time on it. So if you're an actual city, I know some of you represent 10 cities or 15 cities, and I represent one. So you should be able to find at least one of the cities you represent, I think, on this chart. And I think you can see in this committee that
Representative Benson and I, we would get these nice tax cuts, and then the rest of you mostly would see a dramatic property tax increase. And so if you just glance around, I don't know where Clara City is, but that would be a 44.5% property tax increase on the first level value of home. And you can look around the state and see that these aids and credits really working together in a very complicated system absolutely are doing things to reduce taxes for some and raise taxes for others. And so I wanted you to see if you could find your area and see what's going on there. And then finally, I think it was just passed out because it wasn't in the folder, and I think that was my mistake. It looks like this. And this is the revenue estimate for the bill. And this shows us that if, you know, we have a big deficit and if people are serious about reform and want to cut, this bill alone raises over the 3 years on the revenue estimate raises $3 billion roughly. So you could solve half the deficit with this bill. $3 billion right here, or more than half because we're down to $5 billion. And so you can see that repealing all these programs absolutely saves the state a whole bunch of money and would reduce the state's burden and thereby reduce state tax burdens. So, you know, if I may, Madam Chair, just in closing, I want people to really try to do here as you go forward and put together your bill, you know, so many members will pick one piece that benefits them and try to strike it or enhance it and not another. And this bill is sort of saying, hey, the whole system works together, and everybody needs to be thoughtful here as they go forward in looking at the impacts around the state. When we come to the state legislature, we have to be state legislators too. We can't just be legislators from Minneapolis or Clara, I guess you're Clara, or Bloomington or whatever. So we have to think about our actions and what it's going to do. And I think this data definitely shows that the system is equalizing base for poorer parts of the state at the expense, some would argue, maybe pejoratively, of others. But I do want to just in closing say that the aids and credit system, you know, we all argue about what does the aids and credit system exist to do. And some people say it's for lowering property taxes. And others will say, well, it doesn't even work. It doesn't lower property taxes. I think this information shows it does lower property taxes. But others would say that it exists to fund things that people need. And I think that's true, too. I think it does both. There's property tax relief, and there's buying things that people want, like fire trucks, or, you know, having the things that people need in their districts to provide local government services. But I think the third thing that I think is very important for this committee in putting together your division report, Madam Chair, and for the legislature, the whole legislature, is the system works to equalize disparity. And you can see that by looking at the data. If you don't have any of these systems going on, the disparity between the wealthiest communities and the poorest sort of, it blows the roof off that. And so the distance between the best off and the least off moves like this, minus the aids and credits. So, you know, I just hope we'll look at all this. I don't know how, Madam Chair, you would propose to do that. But I do think sometimes the committee can do better work bipartisanly when we sort of tone down the rhetoric, recognize that, you know, some of this stuff actually has a purpose, and then within the sake of a deficit, what are we going to do? With the $5 billion deficit before us, again, this bill would solve $3 billion or billion permanently, and I certainly don't imagine, Madam Chair, that you would take this bill and say, let's just do this. But I want to have the
testimony first.
Yeah, and I want to have the conversation, and you can see, again, some of us would just do great under a bill like this, and most of the state would be hurt by a bill like this. So appreciate your time, Madam Chair.
And Representative and members, we're going to, in the interest of time and out of respect for people who have come to testify, I think we want to move to testimony here first. So we'll catch the people that are coming from out of the building. So we have Chief Ken Prilliman representing the fire chiefs. Is he still here? Okay. And Chief Dan Winkle, you want to come up together perhaps?
Madam Chair, we'd like to give the floor to State Auditor Otto first, if that'd be all right.
Oh, okay. Sorry. State Auditor Otto. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be very brief because there's many people who've been sitting for quite a while and they probably have other things to do. I'm Rebecca Otto, the Minnesota State Auditor, and I'm here today because there is doing away with the Fire State Aid Program, which I think you all know well now that it's a pension program. Minnesota has a pretty good pensions, and we haven't run into problems because we've had really smart policy. Public safety is the biggest thing. It's the biggest part of the budget for cities over 2,500, and I know I want to have the firefighters show up if my home's on fire or that if my life's threatened, police can show up. Almost 23% of the active members right now that are fighting fires are above retirement age. This kind of thing could really threaten our very efficient volunteer system. It's mainly volunteer. And in 2009, there was a 10% increase in benefit payments. These folks don't know this because we just released the report today. We just issued a new report on them. It's very important for recruitment and retention of firefighters. Some communities are having a hard time doing that. And so I would just urge you, if you decide to move forward with the bill, that to make sure this goes to the Pension Commission, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Auditor Otto. And Mr. Prilliman, Chief Prilliman, and Chief Winkle, thank you for coming down today. Who wants to start?
I would, Madam Chair. Ken Prilliman, I'm the Fire Chief for the City of Brooklyn Park and representing the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association. It's a pleasure to be back here again this week to visit with you about this this bill. While the fire service understands in the big picture what is before you in terms of trying to solve, I'd like to remind you of a couple of things as it relates to this bill. The original source of the revenues that ultimately funds the fire aid comes from the gross premium tax. It is not although it is considered a general fund item, it is funded by auto and other insurance premiums that come into the state. That revenue funds, as Auditor Otto pointed out, the state fire department's pension plans. Most of those plans are funded either entirely or mostly by that fund, and without that fund would have a detrimental impact. Even in the city of Brooklyn Park, over 90% of that pension fund is funded through that 2% money or the state aid program that we're talking about today. Around the state, there are a variety, as I testified last week, there's a variety of different pension funds out there. The combination of this bill and any other limit on levies could have a detrimental impact on the actual viability of the plans that exist today and the ability for cities to fulfill the promises that they made to firefighters. And in many cities, this, again, as I testified last week, is the only benefit that they receive. We have many volunteer firefighters who do not earn an hourly wage, who receive no medical, dental, or any other benefit, and the only benefit is the promise of a pension that in many cases is funded at 90% or more by this state aid program. Many of our firefighters today have 15, 20, 30 years of service protecting our communities, and they do that because of having a heart condition, meaning they're placing the needs of others before their own, but they are relying upon this pension to be there when they retire. I would like to correct for the record, I'm not aware of any location in the state where this money is allowed to be used for fire trucks, with all due respect. This is all being funded to the pension plan, and fire departments around the state are still hosting pancake breakfasts in order to raise money for fire trucks and much-needed equipment.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chief Winkle.
My name is Dan Winkle. I'm the fire chief of the city of Andover. I'm here today representing the Minnesota State Fire Department Association. Our membership is about 520 fire departments who have about, we think, 13 to 14,000 members. One of the numbers I think that's important for this committee to know is that 90% of the firefighters in the state of Minnesota, and there are a total of close to 20,000, are volunteer or paid on-call firefighters. And you're talking about their pension programs, as Chief Prilliman stated. And we thank the auditor for her comments because she helps us to track that, of course, and do audits on these programs. But to get down and dirty, we really are affecting our recruitment and retention programs in that, in using Andover as an example, we have an average age of firefighters of over 40 years old, almost 42. Most of them are qualified to go out on a pension. And I can guarantee you that that would happen immediately if this were to pass and go through. Now, what's the negative side of that? And if there is a positive, we'd lose probably 30% of our 50 firefighters would go immediately. And to rehire, to restaff, to retrain that would be an unbelievable cost for us. So that's a huge issue, and I'm sure it would echo across the state. So for the fire service, it's clearly a recruitment and retention issue. As Chief Prilliman stated, the pensions are a big deal. We don't pay a lot of hourly wages. Some of the departments get zero. Some pay, maybe they can get part-time jobs down at McDonald's, and they don't have to risk their lives every day to do what we do as firefighters, that they're working for basically the same kind of hourly rates. So we ask you to consider this as a recruitment and retention issue. For me, that's a big deal. And again, hopefully you will hear from your firefighters. I know you will on this as we bring this forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. And I'm certain we have questions. Unfortunately, we don't have the room here for any more time today. Actually, my question is, why is it organized the way it is in terms of the fire relief aid, if it's sort of a pass-through from insurance premiums, but doesn't seem like it would need to touch the property tax system. But we are going to recess the committee until 7 p.m. tonight. I don't know that we need to ask the fire folks to come back. I don't know if Representative Lomcheski is interested in hearing any more from them. But
well, Madam Chair, and I should just say before we adjourn or recess that I'm unaware of anyone who wants to testify for this bill, but I know there are more who want to testify against it, and I don't know if, I don't think we want to inconvenience the chiefs and firefighters who are here, and I think, the point I'm trying to make in the bill is, you're right, taking all that in isolation. I'm asking members to look at the billion-dollar system, and this could be something retained. But I do want to clarify, if I can, my comment on the fire trucks was not within your pension aids or fire. It was within the LGA. So a lot of cities use their LGA system. But I agree with you. I have the largest volunteer firefighting group in the state of Minnesota. And I think a lot of members in this committee are getting educated right now that they didn't know the property tax aids and credit system is assisting with police and fire and paying their pensions. So I think it's just important you're here so members can learn that, because we have a lot of people here who think they're not benefiting from these systems. And your presence, I think, shows the whole committee and Minnesotans what their taxes are going for. So appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make one more point, and we respect that time is an element, and we appreciate that you have a concern about our time. We're here this morning because this is very important to us, but I would like to point out for the committee that many of the chiefs that are sitting behind me today are part-time fire chiefs. This is not what they do full-time. They've taken days off in order to be here. I'm certain that many of them would be back tonight if we felt like it was needed in order to continue to answer questions and provide some clarity. And I just wanted to put that on the record as well.
Thank you, sir. And I'm my understanding is that a large part of this is informational, and we're really, really dealing with something that is going to, be very different perhaps in the final end. So, but we do have to recess. We'll recess till 7 p.m. tonight in room 10. Thanks all members. We'll call the meeting of the Property and Local Tax Division back to order, and we will resume testimony on House File 38, Representative Levchesky's 398. What is it? 398, Representative Levchesky. Now, I do believe there are folks in the audience who do wish to testify. So first on our list is Jim Atchison, Hennepin County. Is he here? No? Okay. And Patricia Nauman. Well, she might need a little more time. Steve Peterson, are you interested in testifying now? Did you want to testify now or...? Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Sorry.
And please give us your name and who you represent. Thank you. For the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, and I just want to make a few comments here today. I'm guessing that a lot of what Mr. Carlson from the League of Minnesota Cities is going to say we would wish to share in the concerns, but I will speak just generally to our concerns with the bill that is before you. Metro Cities has about 60 legislative policies in all, but a quarter of those policies deal specifically with fiscal issues, tax issues, revenue issues for cities. And the policy that underpins all of those issues is a policy that speaks to the need for a strong state and local fiscal relationship, one that emphasizes adequacy, equity, accountability, transparency, the defining of roles between for state and local governments. And we do believe generally that the state and local relationship is in a very serious decline. Would argue it's broken. We think that this bill would really effectively sever that relationship. I will say there's a couple of exceptions, a couple of things that we think. One exception to that is the bill would create some predictability in revenues by not having, without the revenues and the relationship, I guess that's predictability. So that is an underpinning of our policy. And we also do support enhancing the property tax refund program. Our policy strongly support that. In terms of fiscal disparities, our policies do support the program, although we do support the study that's now underway for possible reforms and improvements to that program, so we would not support a repeal. And I will leave it at that. Thank you very much. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Any questions from the members? All right. Then we'll move on. Mr. Carlson or Mr. Peterson?
I'll go, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. Let me just say at the outset, we respectfully oppose the bill, and we'll raise a few concerns here. I'd like to extend my sympathies to Mr. Hines. I'm sure he had to work hours and hours to try to prepare that run. In my 28 years of working at the Capitol, I don't think I've ever seen a computer run done that tries to model all of these changes at one time. So, Steve, I'm sure you worked late hours, and thank you for your persistence so we could understand the effects of the proposal on property taxes. Let me say that I was a bit surprised when I first looked at the computer run to see the impacts on property taxes. I frankly thought that I would see even larger increases in the tax burdens that occur. Now, I know there are some regional tax increases that are astronomical, to say the least. But as I looked at the run and as I talked to Mr. Hines and as I talked to the Department of Revenue, I realized one thing that you should be aware of is, as you look at this run, that there's a couple of factors that don't readily make themselves apparent as you consider the numbers on those runs. Number one, because of the levy back assumptions that are used in the run, and I'm not going to quibble with those assumptions, there is effectively about $400 or $500 million of money disappearing from the analysis. We're assuming that city councils, county boards, and town boards are not going to replace all of their losses of state aids, and I believe that roughly $400 to $500 million, Mr. Hines, is perhaps the range of money that is kind of disappearing from the system. So, how does that disappear? It would occur most likely in reductions in services to citizens. It could appear as reductions in what little fund balance might be left after all these changes occur. But I think it's important for you to understand that the run, as accurate as it is, does not model all of what is going on. There's about $400 or $500 million worth of reductions in spending that are going on. Number two, the bill does authorize local sales taxes, and there is no impact, there are no revenues reflected in this run of what cities may do with that authorization to enact a local sales tax. Under Representative Lencheski's proposal, the bill would authorize a general sales tax for any governmental use if we follow certain procedures. Again, there's no new revenue reflected from a local sales tax option that is contained in the bill. And then finally, as you look at the run, you should also realize that the property tax refund program, the PTR monies that Representative Lencheski has elevated in the run, do not show up as property tax relief to homeowners. So the extra $210 million of homeowner relief that's in the bill does not show up as a reduction in homeowner taxes, nor in fact does the baseline amount of PTR, which I think is about $300 million a year, give or take a few, 10 or 20 million, is not reflected in the relief that would be provided there as well. Finally, I would just, I guess I would echo two things. One is the concerns of the police officers and firefighters and the funding for local pensions. But finally, In the Department of Revenue analysis of this proposal, I think it's interesting that they include some tax principles at the end of that run, and I think it's probably educational for you to look at those principles. They discuss the effects on transparency, efficiency, equity, stability, short-term stability, long-term competitiveness for businesses, and responsiveness of the tax system. And as you look at those, Department of Revenue's analysis of those trade-offs, I think it's important to remember that those are, in fact, trade-offs. In this proposal, we are sacrificing equity in the system. We're sacrificing some competitiveness for businesses with these other features like transparency, efficiency, perhaps long-term stability, as Patty Nelman indicated. But I would like you to think about those as really trade-offs as we look at how this proposal impacts the property tax system. Madam Chair, those conclude my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Peterson.
Hi, my name is Steve Peterson here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. We represent 77 cities outside the metro area throughout Greater Minnesota. Please excuse me as I am flying without the teleprompter as I have appeared to have left my notes on the printer. So this is going to be from the heart. the bulk of my, for a Greater Minnesota Cities, it's a pretty easy call when you look at this bill. Just looking at page 4, page 3, and page 1 of the Steve Hines runs. And you can see that not only, you know, for the statewide, it is a large property tax increase if you get rid of all the local aids and credit programs. But in Greater Minnesota, you see that it is, in many cases, double that of the metro area. Just looking, you know, at the Greater Minnesota Cities on page 4, a 28% increase in homeowner property taxes. For low-valued commercial industrial, 10.5. For high-valued, 8.5, or 8.8. You look in the metro area, you know, a 9% increase for homeowners, which is a substantial increase, no question. But you look at the commercial industrial, and you have a 1.1% increase for the low-valued and a 0.4 decrease for the high-valued. And this really goes to the heart of aids and credits for Greater Minnesota. It does help keep us competitive. And that is why we have fought in the past for local government aid funding. It's why we've fought in the future. It's why we continue to fight. It is for this very reason of how when we start backing away from the Minnesota miracle, the idea that geography should not matter where you live to having access to quality city services, we start getting these different impacts where we'll see very large increases in our communities, and I think it would be very detrimental. Also, it's no surprise that it's hitting us a little harder in the increases because the formulas used, and I'll speak particularly of local government aid, fund cities with higher needs or lower tax bases. Lower tax bases are predominantly in Greater Minnesota. When you remove those are the cities that are going to be hurt the hardest. As Gary Carlson pointed out, there is an option of a local option sales tax. However, local option sales taxes and sales tax bases vary just as much, if not more, than property tax bases. So we go away from one problem of saying we're not going to equalize property tax bases, and then we add another problem of saying we're going to have sales tax bases. So cities that have strong sales taxes will have the community goods, will have the services, will have lower property taxes. Cities that do not will not. And it's the whole reason that we have the aids and credits program. So with that, we are also respectfully opposing Representative Lucheski's bill. However, the aids and credits number for 2012 did look okay. Thank you.
Any questions of Mr. Peterson? All right. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. And are there more testifiers? Okay. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be quick. I frankly congratulate Representative Lucheski for identifying the breadth of the effects of the state's property tax relief programs. I think she has done a good job with the assistance of Mr. Hines of identifying the geographic impacts as well as the impacts of individual properties. I simply want to limit my comments to one more obscure item of her legislation that has only become to be recognized by the tax committee in the past two or 3 years, thanks again to former Chair Lucheski, and that's the maintenance of effort requirement. The document that I've had passed out identifies three main maintenance of effort requirements imposed on counties in Minnesota. The lion's share of maintenance of effort requirements, which is an explicit dollar amount that a local government is required to spend, falls on counties. Cities have do share in some instances in what's called the library maintenance of effort. But so I just want to point out, because you will be seeing other pieces of legislation dealing with this topic in subsequent hearings, I anticipate, by this committee or perhaps in the Health and Human Services Committee or the Full Tax Committee. Over $227 million is required to be spent by counties this year, or we're sanctioned for not meeting those. This is without regard to the needs of the clients, without regards to the needs of the community, or the decisions of the county board. So I just want to take this opportunity to make you aware of this provision that is repealed in Representative Ledesky's bill. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Members, any questions of Mr. Carlson? Any discussion? All right, Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rice, testifying tonight on behalf of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, Minneapolis Police and Fire Relief Associations, and the Police Officers Alliance of Minnesota, which is an organization representing approximately 3,000 police officers in the state. And my testimony, Madam Chair, is directed to the provisions of Representative Ledesky's bills that would eliminate the police state aid program, the fire state aid program, the insurance surcharge aid program, and amortization aid, and tangentially the PRA aid program. We do appreciate that Representative Ledesky has decided to raise everybody's hackles in the state, so there's an opportunity to address this issue. And they are very important, and what I'd like to say with respect to fire state aid, there were about 25 fire chiefs from around the state that came today who are very, very concerned about it, and the state auditor came, and with good reason. As I understand, and I'd certainly be happy to be corrected by your excellent staff, I believe that the first state tax ever imposed in this state was the insurance tax on insurance policies, and it was dedicated to help firefighting companies from around the state of Minnesota. It's been a provision that goes back to the 1870s. It's been an aid program that has survived a long time. The formula is based 50% on population, 50% on valuation, and that aid is dedicated to fire pensions exclusively. And it's been a good program. Likewise, the police state aid program was initially tied to the gross premiums tax on auto insurance policies, 2%, started out at 1% and was subsequently raised and devoted to police pensions. And every police officer in the state now, wherever you're located, gets the same amount. We have county sheriff in Clay County, or a police officer in Minneapolis, University of Minnesota police officer, highway patrol officers, game wardens, BCA agents, all those government units that employ police officers get, last I looked, approximately $8,000 per police officer to pay pension costs. And employers then, when they hire a police officer, wherever they are in the state, has that cost paid. And those two aid programs really undergird a pension system that is established by the legislature. Minnesota did something, and I've testified in other committees, when Minnesota set up PELRA, they took pensions off the bargaining tables. You can't bargain pensions in Minnesota. The pension policy is set by the state legislature, the contribution rates, the benefits are set by the state, and Minnesota is a matching contributory program where the employee puts in money and the employer puts in money. For police and fire, it's a 60-40 split. But those plans are well-funded. And Minnesota, unlike some other states, our neighbor to the east, Wisconsin, that allowed you to collectively bargain contributions, when you start letting cities collectively bargain pensions, you open the door to a lot of potential problems. It's easy to not pay pensions today, or as Wimpy said, I'd gladly pay you Thursday for a hamburger today. Pensions, it's easy to kick down the road and ignore them. And One point that I'd like to make, and the fiscal analyst, Mr. Michaels, pointed out to me the memo that Mr. Mosman wrote and your staff assumes that there'll be a 50% add back if you cut levies on page 2. It's predicated on the assumption that the levy back will be 50% for aid cuts up to 10% increase. Up to 10% increase in property taxes, any cut beyond that levy would be a 30% rate. Now, that was in general, and historically the state has never touched these aid programs, which for, I think, good reason. But in this case, if you're going to cut these pension aids, it's all going to fall back, or it should all fall back on the cities to pay these pension costs unless you want to short the pension funds. And believe me, as policymakers, the last thing you should want to do is cut pensions, because it might look easy, but you know the path to perdition is paved with good intentions. I mean, New Jersey, we're not New Jersey, we're not Illinois, we're not California, because you've had a pension commission, you've overlooked these policies, the state has stepped up with these police state aid programs, fire amortization, PRA thing, to make sure these pensions are as solid as you fiscally can make them. And I would submit that a little paternalism in this area goes a long way. I know you want to say local control, but having the locals, I testified, Madam Chair, on your bill the other day, we're working on some legislation about the insurance contributions in school district. I tried to point out, and I think you were sympathetic, that there's some difference between the pension issue and health insurance, where you do allow pensions to be, or health insurance things to be bargained. That created a big issue in this state. I mean, pretty massive unfunded liabilities. And I would just submit, Madam Chair, these aid programs, there's a long history behind all of them. And quite, you know, on a partisan basis, the police and fire state aid programs were set up at a time when the Republicans controlled the legislature. And they are tied to a specific purpose. The formulas, I would say, probably on balance, probably favor greater Minnesota, in part, particularly on the police state aid thing, because it's a per capita amount. But, you know, the police officers in the state are grateful for that. My clients, the fire aid program, I think is also fair. It provides that level of service. You need police officers everywhere in the state. You need fire protection. The main inducement for these, and 90% of our firefighters, I was going to say, 1,600 full-time firefighters, about 1,900 volunteers. We're 47th in the country, according to the Taxpayers Association, on what we spend on fire protection in this state. Amongst the very lowest, it's because you, Representative Lemire, are a volunteer. It's a very efficient, cheap thing, and the one inducement is this fire state aid program, a major inducement to do it. Many cities don't levy, but if you knock this program out, you're going to do one of two things: make cities levy back for that, or put people in a situation where they don't know if their pensions are going to be there. And that's a real scary thought. And you say, well, it can't happen. It's happened in other states. And because policymakers were not wise in doing making these things. And they're, you know, and the significance of it, it's about $100 million a year, and that's a lot of money. There's no doubt that's real money. But and another point I made before, I'll make it again, some of my colleagues chimed me on it. These police and firefighters are not covered by Social Security. The only pension they get is what this legislature grants them. And it's more than just a pension. It's their disability plan. If they're disabled in their job, the full-time people, that's their disability plan. They don't have a Social Security disability plan, and it's their survivor plan. So it's three insurance packages put into one. It's a pension plan, it's a disability plan, it's a life insurance plan. And if you go out and price that in the private market, we have a 401k in my firm. We put in 6%, but we also have a life insurance policy and a disability insurance policy. And you start adding those costs up, and they're not cheap. And I'll conclude that on each of these categories, I could go on for a much longer period of time on the history of each of these aid programs. But it's vitally important to PRA. That aid goes throughout the whole system in PRA to make sure that plan stays on target. It was stuff that went through the Pension Commission, previous finance things. They're not escalating amounts for in several regards. Similarly, on the amortization aids, where the legislature looked back under circumstances where employers perhaps didn't, you know, for a long period of time until 1969 when the police state aid program came in, some of these pension plans that had been around for almost 100 years had a few $100,000 in them. They just simply, you know, policymakers didn't look ahead and say we need to fund them. It was, you know, it was easy to set these things up and make the promises. It was a lot harder to keep them. So, again, I'd applaud, I don't know if I applaud Representative Lincheski for bringing the bill forward. She got a lot of hearts racing, but it was good in the sense that we had a chance to bring these forward to the committee, and you're going to hear this from everyone, don't touch my program, but on these police, fire, and pension aid programs, there's a long, strong history for them, and I would say they're targeted to specific areas, and because of the control that the auditor has and the pension commission has, I think you can be very confident that these dollars are being used for the purposes intended, and as I say, a little paternalism goes a long, long way, at least on these pension things, and I really caution you to not back off and leave it to local units of government to levy these things back, because somebody will come along and someone could come along with a good idea and say it doesn't make sense to do it. Or I'll conclude with this. My mother at Christmas gave her 11 grandchildren each, for her, a very, you know, significant Christmas present. And I had one son at USC who's in business, and he put his money in the stock market and is doing fine. I have a second son who's a major at Purpich in the art stuff, and the one son still has the money, and the other one has paying off his credit card bills. So, you know, just like the biblical tale, one servant tripled the money and another one doubled it and someone else buried it in a can. Anything's possible with some of these local units of government. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any discussion, members? All right. Thank you, Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And who else do we have? Any other folks wanted to testify on behalf of the bill, before or against? And any final comments, Representative Lincheski?
Madam Chair, maybe I should sit over here. I did just have one more hand up, if you'd permit me, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I really appreciate so much that you took the time to hear this bill, because you're tasked with the big burden to be a major contributor here to wrestling with the state budget. And I think what this bill is doing for us is allowing members to see that you know, everything in here is really sensitive to someone, and maybe as we have to make tough choices, we can sort of soften the debate about, you know, who's not deserving and what's a waste of money and who's really doing, you know, good, bad, or otherwise, and just really see that the state is in the game of equalization to the tune of $1 billion a year. We are absolutely, as a state, choosing to be unlike most states who don't equalize. Think about 40 states around there in the country don't do equalization, so they don't do these programs. And Minnesota has bipartisanly demonstrated a commitment to understand that we are not all situated exactly the same, and we can see when you turn them all off, the folks with the highest property tax increases are currently, you know, you could not, I'm not trying to use it pejoratively, but they're sort of the winners in the current system. Because without the system, their taxes are going to go through the roof. So you can see what all that state revenue that's being collected through income and sales tax is doing across the state. And so I think everyone needs to choose wisely as we go forward. I thought it was great that the firefighters and fire chiefs were here today, and it was just sort of a moment for everyone to understand that this committee is in charge of that money. I think often people think it's the pension commission. And I think Mr. Rice's testimony is right. You know, people have looked at this repeatedly in both parties and haven't touched that, because they felt that that was, you know, kind of one of the places in first place. But the list is long of revenue, and, you know, things are going to have to be cut, and I know that that's not going to be an easy task. I just appreciate so much us trying to get our heads around what is happening across the state when you look at the system together, because the temptation is always to look at one piece and make your argument. And I finally just passed this out to make the point that, if I wanted to make the sort of just for my town one piece argument, this is what it would look like. This is what a dollar levied and a business in my district, where it goes. So I think it's just interesting for people to see. This is only in my city, and I've got the worst situation in the state, that if you levy a dollar on a business in Bloomington, the first 32 cents off the top goes to fiscal disparities, to somebody else. And then the next 27 cents goes to the state general tax. So we're up to almost 60 cents on the dollar. It doesn't stay in our community, just right out of the chute. And then we spend 14 cents to Hennepin County, 12 cents to our city, 11 cents to our school, and 4 cents somewhere else. So there aren't a lot of places in the state that can produce a document like this, and the only reason I wanted to do that is so people can understand we aren't all similarly situated, and we just need to, I think, be a little more tolerant of each other and each other's perspective, as not so much even as Republicans and Democrats, just where we sit on the map and what this whole system is doing. And I appreciate so very much your willingness to hear this bill.
Thank you, Representative. I think we all had our eyes opened. I think we have a much bigger appreciation for really what we're dealing with and the kind of numbers, really, that are moving backwards and forwards. So I'm going to move that House File 398 be laid over for possible inclusion in the property and local sales tax bill as amended, House File 398 as amended. And next up we have Representative Lemire, House File 551.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
And I should... And I will... Did you want to move your bill, Representative Lemire?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move House File 551.
Okay, and you want to give us a little explanation about it?
If you guys have this handout, it looks like this, and on the other side it'll have that on it. And what it does is it equalizes the penalty for property tax, late payments on property taxes. Right now, non-homesteads get a higher interest charged upon their penalty. And what this does is it removes the it moves the non-homestead penalty payment up into the homestead and cabins payment. So it'll turn from, it'll go from this to this. It's a two-sided. There you go. Yep. And on the back side of that, you'll see that that's the way it was. So the reason for this was it was brought to my attention by our local county auditor, and he thought it was unfair that we're charging business owners more of a property tax, a late penalty, than those of homestead and cabins. And if you look at the revenue, it increases transparent accountability. It's a uniform penalty clause for all property types. And it also increases competitive for businesses by lowering the late payment for businesses and all the other, the efficiency, equity, stability, and the responsiveness to economic conditions remain neutral, and there's no impact to the state government. I have no testifiers here today. I'm open to any questions that you might have.
Any questions, members? Any discussion? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Lemire, did you ask for a local impact note? I assume, but I might be wrong, that these late payment penalties actually go to the local governments, but I...
That's correct. No, I did not ask for one.
And Madam Chair...
And Loeffler?
I would hope that we would ask for that before we act on this finally, because I think we need to know what the range of impacts might be on this. I have no clue, but I suspect given the tough economic times right now, we've got more people and businesses struggling to pay their property taxes.
Yes.
And Representative Lemire, did you say that you had asked for the local fiscal note?
No, I did not.
Okay.
No, I just asked one. I just received the one from Department of Revenue, and that's it. I didn't ask for a local impact.
Right.
I just feel that it's unfair that if you have a credit card, it doesn't matter if you're a business or an individual, you charge the same tax rate, and I believe that the local governments should have the same penalty payment for both businesses and homesteads.
And we will want a local fiscal note, but that can be requested.
All right.
So, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lemire, I'm just wondering, with this change, is there any differentiation on the size of businesses, whether these are individual entrepreneurs, home-based, for example, or a smaller business, or does this apply to all businesses, whether they're mom and pop or if they're Target Corporation or Best Buy?
Representative Benson, it will apply to all businesses.
All right. Representative Crawford.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lemire. This doesn't just apply to businesses, does it? It's every class. Is that what you're getting
Correct.
To?
Oh, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Lemire.
Correct.
So there's 50, however many classes, and we would all equalize that.
Yep. Yes.
All right. Other questions? Oh, and we have a testifier. All right. Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I just did speak to Representative Lemire about some of the concerns that I'll be sharing right now. First, I'll confirm that Representative Loeffler is right on. The reduction of the penalties for the non-homestead property will have significant impact on cities, counties, and school districts. I also suggest to the committee it will have a impact contrary to the Department of Revenue analysis on education aids. There's what has known as the county apportionment deduction from the general education revenue, and I've spoke with Mr. Strom. He didn't come. He's still wants to research it some more. But these penalties are part of the county apportionment and offset the state's cost for the general education formula. And consequently, if you ask for a fiscal note, I think that will be apparent. With that, I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions of Mr. Carlson? All right. Any other testimony? Mr. Representative Lemire?
This isn't a, it shouldn't be, late penalties, I don't believe, should be considered a revenue source for our counties, and our businesses already pay a higher penalty as the homesteaded properties, and I believe if we're going to have a higher property tax rate and a higher penalty, this is, again, against business, and I believe that simplifying this penalty for property taxes, putting the businesses up with the homestead and cabins is a fair thing to do, and it'll increase business competitiveness. Businesses up with the homestead and cabins is a fair thing to do, and it'll increase business competitiveness.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm on a little bit of thin ice here, but I do believe that we have to worry a little bit about dropping the penalty interest rate too low to the point that businesses start to use this in a sense as a loan for cash flow purposes. I heard this morning on National Public Radio about how large corporations keep hanging on to a lot of their cash rather than hiring people because they're worried that they could once again be in the situation when the financial markets kind of blew up and they had no access to cash. And we know that being able to get loans as a small business or a large business can sometimes be difficult. And if you can basically, without even having to go through any paperwork, get a pretty affordable loan from your local governments without having to ask their permission, we might have some people who actually don't need it using this as a cash flow tool. And I think we need to be careful. I think it's harder to establish criteria for need on businesses than it is for individuals in terms of ability to pay. But I think if it gets too low, we might actually see some misuse of this relief that you're trying to provide. And I know that's not your intent, But I think we just need to think about that because the financial markets have been pretty wild, and I know our businesses have had a hard time accessing affordable loans.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, the chair will lay House File 551 over for possible inclusion in the property and local division report.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Lemire. And let's see, we have another. Want to do the 338? Yep. We have House File 338, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lincheski, another bill.
Thank you, Madam. House File 338 is much simpler and just as controversial, and that is what I'm doing in this bill is just eliminating tax increment financing going forward, not affecting any of the 2,000 tax increment finance districts that exist in the state of Minnesota right now, letting them clock out as they will over time, but prohibiting any more tax increment financing districts. And I understand that local units of government view these as a tool, and they like them. And what I'm doing here is saying, you know, the property taxpayers, the residents, are going to stop subsidizing these property tax subsidies for developments, thereby reducing property tax burdens across the state because these exist everywhere. And so that's pretty much it, eliminating TIF going forward.
Very good. Any discussion about House File 338? And do you have testifiers then that are going to support or speak in opposition?
The opposition.
Okay. Ms. Nauman, please come forward.
No surprise. Madam
Yes,
Chair,
please
members.
Please state your name and Thank who you represent.
Patricia Nauman, Executive Director of Metro Cities, here today to respectfully oppose the bill before you, and I am speaking on behalf of both Metro Cities and the League of Minnesota Cities today about this bill. And really the issue for us is that tax increment financing is one of few and a very primary tool for cities to do economic development and redevelopment. It becomes an even more important tool as federal and state resources are shrinking for work like this. It just becomes all the more important of a tool for cities to do important economic development, redevelopment, to address problem properties, neighborhood blight, and decline of neighborhoods. So we would respectfully oppose the bill. And again, I do just want to point out that that it's as state and federal governments, as the state and the federal government are facing increasing deficits, there's just fewer resources to do this kind of, to provide to cities for doing these kinds of work. And so this is just an important tool for us and even more important at this time. So thank you very much.
Any questions of Ms. Nauman? All right. Thank you very much. And other testifiers? Anyone else in the audience? All right. Oh, yeah. Did you have any other comments then, Representative Lincheski? Oh, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How long has the TIFs been around?
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Detmer. I don't know, but I bet Mr. Michael knows. I'm not
Michael,
sure.
Michael, how about a quick lesson?
But there were many districts, and they've been tightened a little bit, and I think the pressure will be on you all to release them and loosen them up, and I hope you'll keep them as tight as possible if you can't eliminate it. But I don't know when exactly they started, in the 70s, maybe?
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, the law that authorized Minnesota local government cities mainly to use tax increment was actually enacted in the 1940s. But the first district was created, I believe, by Robbinsdale in 1969. It was enacted as part of the federal government's sort of offering urban renewal money, and it was actually sort of mandated as part of that and was in the housing and redevelopment law. There were a series of special laws that were enacted in the 70s and then general laws in 74, and then the major law was enacted in 79, and it really didn't start until the 80s in major scope.
And how many of them have officially closed? I mean, of the total that have started, do we know? I think that's the goal, isn't it? That they start and they stop.
Anticipated somebody might ask that question, and then I looked for 2009, 153 districts were decertified. That was an unusually high year because there were these grandfathered pre-79 districts that were all required to clock out no later than 2009, and so there was a little bit of a pig in the python kind of an effect. But I think typically they're, 100 or something like that, that typically decertify.
Seems like that's the era we're in, the pig in the python here. Yeah. So. All right, very good. Any other discussion? Oh, Representative Crawford.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lynchewski, I've seen a couple of these projects, and some of them seem to me to be pretty good. We had this old ice cream plant that stood empty for 20 years, and somebody used a TIF project to tear it down and put some development in. And then we also had somewhere somebody took some vacant land and used it for some apartment buildings, which, I don't know, I didn't think that was a very good use of it. I know you're asking to eliminate all of them. Is there any that you would rank more favorably than others, or in your experience?
Representative Lemchesky.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Crawford. I think just how you just ranked them is exactly right, and I am taking an extreme position here, but you're right. Blighted uses and soils districts and maybe low-income housing, those are the intentions. We've moved off to green fields and vacant land with really high-valued property that should play fair on the free market, and I think just how you expressed what it's intended for and what's been happening is exactly the problem. And I understand why city councils do them, because they get to leverage their own tax base and the whole county's. So they're spending their city tax base, and they're not the county commissioners, but they're spending the whole county's money too. So the incentives are sort of perverse to do this, and as long as it exists, you know, it's people are tempted to do some of the things they maybe shouldn't be doing, and I would argue that the economic development ones are the most dangerous ones, and then the ones that people are most tempted to do because they think it'll bring some big new business to their area.
Okay, any other questions? Any other testifiers? All right. The chair will lay House File 338 over for possible inclusion in the division report.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lynchewski. All right, we come to House File 679 and Representative Marquardt. Do you want to move your bill, Representative Marquardt?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will move House File 679 for possible inclusion.
Okay, very good. Do you want to give us an explanation of what you're doing here?
Thank you very much. In short, hopefully this will create less disgruntled property taxpayers. That's the goal. Here's what it does. Is in March of every year, everyone gets a notice of valuation and classification for taxes payable in the next year. And there's a spot there that says property classification, and it will have your prior year's classification, right? Rate or your class. So it could be seasonal rec, it could be ag homestead, residential homestead, commercial industrial. And then it has your next year's payable classification. And I'll admit, I haven't heard from a lot, but I've heard from two residents who, for whose ever fault it was, just did not notice that until they started seeing their property taxes go up and then went back and looked and saw that their classification rate had changed to a higher rate. Now, I mean, the big question is, you know, how tuned in are you expecting property tax owners to be? You know, how much responsibility should they be doing? And you know, it's clearly stated on the form, you know, what that is. What my bill would do is somewhere on the form, if the classification has changed, would say your classification has changed. Would just be one more notice there. Now, I am adding one more line, but I'm also deleting one more line because we're taking off the limited market value line, which is obsolete, and also cleaning it up and taking out references to this old house exclusion. People can still get this old house, but it was done away with the 03 assessment year, but people are still getting that. But any kind of notices that would say you could qualify for that is eliminated. So, according to Representative Dietrich's chart, it increases transparency, but does decrease efficiency because you are adding another line. So, it's, you know, like I said, I mean, this is kind of up to the committee. I mean, how, you know, the question is, you know, how in tune should property taxpayers be? I know I look at mine, but, you know, you would probably notice if something happened. But these are two folks that did call me and didn't notice it or didn't realize it until their property taxes had gone up. Now, certainly if your property taxes went down, you're probably not going to make any hay of this. But so, members, that's the bill.
All right, Representative Marquardt. Representative Crawford.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Marquardt, thanks for bringing this forward. I think it's long overdue. We had a taxpayer this past year that happened to. It wasn't on his prime residence, but I think it was on a vacant piece of land. And the city had changed the classification about 5 years ago, and they didn't notice it. And now they were going to do something with the property. And, of course, they went back and during the negotiations found out what the classification was, and so they were back at the county trying to, you know, get some money back. So I think it's a function of the how our property tax system is complicated. We've talked about that, and this is just one little thing, but I think it would help people to as they pay their property taxes. So I approve.
All right. Anyone from counties have some testimony? Great. Please state your name and who you represent.
My name is Jim Atchison. I'm the Hennepin County Assessor, and I'm here this evening to represent the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to speak. From a tax administrator perspective, are you ready for this? Nice. This is a very good idea.
Wow. Hey. One out of ten.
But our only concern is all the different programmers across the state that would then have to reprogram all of their systems in order to print that line on there. And I don't know how much that would cost. I have absolutely no idea, even within our own county, what that would cost. But in Hennepin County alone, there are four different services that print value notices. So it would magnify across the state, but it is a very good idea, and from the MAO's perspective, from their mission statement, it does fit their mission statement in a sense that it makes the system more understandable and transparent to taxpayers. Just a little background: changes in taxes and the bill before you really is coming at the sub-record level. And the subrecord is simply a different use or tax level on each individual property. Value notices are mailed on the parcel basis. So if you own a property with multiple parcels, you're going to get multiple tax statements. For the normal single-family home, you would have one subrecord. For a normal Green Acres property, you would have four subrecords. Our computer system currently can handle 8 subrecords, and there's some horror stories across the state that there are dozens potentially of subrecords that are out there. On our current property tax statement, we actually print 2 subrecord values and classifications plus whether they're homesteaded or non-homesteaded. So this bill, as it's presented, would really be for those, at least in Hennepin County and for most of the counties in the state, would be for those properties that have 3 or more sub-records, as we are already covering sub-records 1 and 2. And again, we do believe this is a very good idea, and our only concern is regarding the programming costs to get this implemented on the tax statements. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your time.
Thank you.
Representative Marquardt, are you planning to get a local fiscal impact statement then?
Madam Chair, I had not requested one on that, certainly can. And I do appreciate the comments here, and I think it's kind of a balancing act between, you know, increased transparency to the property taxpayer and, you know, what costs there might be. I mean, that's certainly a trade-off. I understand that. But I, as Representative Crawford said, it's a complicated system, and even folks who deal with it all the time find it complicated. And I just think anything you can do to, you know, just put something out there, especially when there's been a change that can be quite major in impact on property taxes, are on that statement.
Ms. Schill, did you have a comment?
Madam Chair, I would just like to remind members of the committee that a local impact note can only be requested by the chair and ranking minority of the Tax Committee and the Ways and Means Committee. A local impact note usually takes 3 or more weeks to process, and they are done by the Office of Management and Budget. They have an in-depth kind of analysis where MMB asks a number of different interested parties, mostly our local partners, whether they are counties, cities, other local entities, to give information on whatever the subject is. And so it is not lightly that we take the request for a local note on any particular bill. That's why the authority for requesting one of the Commissioner of Management and Budget, it's so narrow and only a few people can do it. Also, ranking minorities of each of those committees can request a note. And so I would just advise the committee for requests for local notes. It would probably be either Chair David's, or I know Representative Lemchesky could do so as ranking member of the Tax Committee, Representative Holberg, or the ranking minority of that committee.
All right, very good. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Just curious, in the current tax statements, when was the last time there was a change on the tax statement?
Mr. Etchison.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer. Well, major change?
Correct. We were talking about there's a cost of making a change, and when was the last time there was an update or a change to the statement?
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, the major changes were a few years ago when they brought in the veterans market exclusion. We had to have a line for that, and then prior to that would have been this old house and the limited value numbers. So it's been a couple years and then several years prior to that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Atchison, I'm not sure how frequently classifications change on properties, and would it be more cost-effective to just require a notice? I mean, if it hasn't already been, the request for change hasn't been made by the property owner, like if you buy a house that was rented and now you want to homestead it, obviously that's an action by the new owner. But if you prospectively change the classification, it seems to me it probably wouldn't happen that often, and would that be a more practical approach?
Mr. Atchison?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, we're in the midst of several changes within the Green Acres category, so in the last few years there's been a lot of changes, and many, many of those have affected their bottom line on taxes. We have internally in our office even considered that it might be cheaper for us to do a list of our 426,000 parcels and find any of those that have changed and send them a letter. Would be on the surface possibly cheaper than reprogramming our system.
Representative Loeffler?
Sounds to me like there's some creative problem solving that might be pursued on this.
Very good. Any other discussion on the bill? All right. Did you have any final comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for hearing the bill. Thank you.
Very good. Well, we'll lay that House File 679 over for possible inclusion in the division report. And do we have any other business tonight? Any other final comments, anybody? If not, great. We are adjourned. Thank you very much.